of this. It is our practice when having what we call inviting stakeholders here. And sometimes because we haven't yet reached a final position on whether this would be a bill, you follow, that decision is still being taken, or will we simply call for things and different measures and move towards a voluntary approach? Now, we're basically collecting information and hearing what different stakeholders have to say. So, for example, when we've invited the banks before, they've all come, I think there were about five here on one occasion in Good Hope. We had FNB, Nedbank, Standard Bank, and Capitec. And I think African Bank was also there. And we were able to, open the door to them in inverted commas and hear what they have to say. Because no matter who you are, you share one thing in common. You're a bank. You're a financial house. All right, of course. But you know yourself you have different packages and approaches. You know that. That's what makes you different. That gives you some sort of capacity to compete with each other in an open manner, etc. So where the banking association comes in, it is a membership organization. In the same way, we have architects, we have verification agencies, we have steel, we have a number, manufacturers, etc. All of them have got some form of an association. The association is always very welcome to come. But as I said, you're not taking the place of or speaking for the individual banks. Do you see? That is not the purpose at all. And I would like to make that quite clear. All of you need to come properly prepared, of course being short notice. You may require more time, you know, naturally. And you will be afforded that opportunity to send something down. Now I hope I've made myself clear. So you're not talking to a bill. You're assisting us to take a decision. What should we do in this case? We know what we want to achieve, you see? We want to achieve what we initially said was debt forgiveness, if I'm not mistaken. And then we said, no, it's debt relief. It's a different measures around debt relief. Has this been done anywhere? And yes, we had documents shared with us, studies that indicated the NINA, etc. We said, oh, okay, so we don't know about how well some of them have worked because it's too soon to tell, but we do have other data. So that is there. The other thing is, contrary to what some of you think, I actually meet with some of you CEOs. And I already know the position. That's me individually, not the committee. Do you follow? And I am obliged for stakeholders to come here and share their views with us. You know, not you don't want the John Fubbs's view. You want a collective position from a multi-party committee. And that is very, very important that we get that. So, and furthermore, this is recorded. So, you know, should we have made a mistake or whatever, we're able to go back and check. So that is the basis that we do it. We have never had the misfortune to summons anyone. And since 1994, when I was a publicly elected representative, 10 years in Gauteng, I've never had to summon anyone. Because I have found South Africans, whether in the corporate sector, unions, civil society, or whatever, are generally keen to put their point of view on the table and be heard. So this is what this affords you. It affords you an opportunity. And from there, the subcommittee will do a lot more unpacking than we will do in this committee, you see. And then they will come with a recommendation to me. And I say to me as chair of the full committee. Now they all know how it works, you see. So that's why I don't sit on the subcommittee, so that I am outside of that when I receive this information. So as long as we all have a clearer understanding, it means that one thing we haven't informed you of, indeed, we would like to have reached a position before we rise, so that we can take some sort of memorandum to the House, because the House would have to adopt it, because this is a committee bill, which we're entitled to produce. So I don't know if there's any need for clarification, just so that things run a lot more smoothly, and no one is talking for anyone else. You're talking for your own principle. That's how I understand it. Right. Now, any queries? Clarifications? No. All right. So I would like you to breathe in peace, you know, and explain yourselves a little better. All right. Now, am I right, Mr. William, Honourable Williams? I see you very actively there involved. And so have we got the screens? Right. Now we have the Standard Bank here. I'm just looking at the actual entities. We have APSA, we have Nedbank, we have African Bank. Where's the African Bank person? Oh, right. Mm-hmm. The First Rand Bank. Capitec. Ah, good. And Department of Trade and Industry, the DDG, the most senior person from the department is here. That is Mr. Nyatsi Tenzi. The National Credit Regulator with her team, Mrs. Machigari. And the Legal Office of Parliament. Ah, yes, down there. Yes. All right, you know, when you've been in grey, it kind of merged with the computer behind you. Right, so thank you very much, Advocate Vandermeer. Okay. Now that it's 10 past, we are required to listen to the bells, because we're all aware that anything can happen in the House. So as soon as we hear those bells, members, I hope this is clear, I will simply adjourn for a few moments. You will remain here, and then we will return. Is that in order? Right. On that note then, I want to thank the committee. And you'll be heartened to hear, members of the committee, you're listening, because this could be good news, Honourable MacPherson. Very good news. It would appear as if the Honourable Froling did not know about the Wednesday situation. So it could change. So let us just hang in there, all right? Okay, on that note, any adoption? Can someone propose the adoption of the agenda? Yes, Honourable MacPherson, is that a proposal to adopt the agenda? And seconded by Honourable Williams. Right. Apologies, we have a medical one from Honourable Mantash. Right, we have two members who sit in this committee and one who sits on the subcommittee. The Honourable Alberts, as you know, sits on the subcommittee as well. He's just away on party business. The Honourable Yesterhazen may well have a family challenge, medical challenge, that he is attending to. But he tries to be here. Anyway, it does say that Standard Bank would be starting at 5 past. Now, if you look at that means probably just about 1530, 1535, you know, round about there. Let's see how it goes. By now you should know this presentation off by heart. Right, let's go.
Thank you, Chair, and good afternoon to the committee members and the other representatives. We would just like to start with a quick introduction, specifically that sort of states our views at the bank, and the principles we stand for, and then our existing methodologies that we've adopted on debt relief. We'll then go and share our views on legislation of debt relief and a conclusion. So to not waste time, I think it's just important to probably state that as Standard Bank, we strongly believe that Africa is our home and we drive growth. And therefore, we can never, ever exonerate ourselves from the responsibility of growing this country. And we believe that our fortunes are tied to the fortunes of this country. So there are a couple of duties we believe we have. One, we believe we have a duty to support sustainable measures to help grow the economy. We believe that we have to foster an environment where responsible lending can take place, and therefore we support initiatives that create a healthy consumer with affordable debt granted responsibly. We support all initiatives to find solutions for consumers who are, for various reasons, are over-indebted. The third point is we at any given time, we believe it's our duty to adopt customer-centric strategies that will yield the best results for all parties involved when we're dealing customers in distress. And we think that's actually more important in the times where customers find themselves in indebtedness for reasons that's beyond their own cause. And so we truly believe that the committee work, that the duty and the work that this committee is doing is quite important. So we do take the indebtedness and all the challenges posed by the economy to our customers and the country quite seriously. And therefore, we will continue to engage with all the regulators, the committee members, the DTI, and any stakeholders to find solutions. And we'll fully participate with the Banking Association and other parties to find initiatives. So that's really the start, just to say we're fully committed to the process and we believe it's core to our responsibilities. So what then exists today, we've got many solutions that we believe exist. We don't think they're perfect, but we just felt it's worthwhile to start saying there's legislated solutions like debt review, there's prescription, there's in dupla, but there's also non-legislated debt relief actions that we implement in our daily processes. Things like we give assistance to retrenched workers based on individual assessments. We have payment moratoriums and payment holidays. We've got restructures where we reduce installments when customers can't afford. We've got debt consolidation. And it's important to state that debt consolidation, in this case, we don't sell debt consolidation as a loan that you sell, but we're helping customers reduce their debt and drop the installment and reduce their loans. We give rate concessions in the process. We have bank-assisted sale of property so that we don't have to go to SIE. And we help customers get better prices than they would get in selling execution. We have selective realization of security, which is especially intended to protect child-headed households. We have extended repayment plans for student people who've got student loans. Post-completing their studies and starting work, we give them time so they can get a breather and they don't have to be under pressure. And we have settlement policies where we discount low debts when customers have shown commitment in their repayment. So we do quite a lot of things that we believe do provide a bit of relief, and whilst we're solving for income challenges through other initiatives that we'll talk about in the next slide. So some of the initiatives then that we started sort of building that support these things, and it's worth noting that we've got over 60 staff members who are dedicated to just assisting customers. And their job is to make sure that we're finding solutions and understanding the customer's distressed environment, and we work with that. We've just already recently updated all our debt review systems and processes, and that was the aim of making sure that we can aid in the process of helping with the debt review processes. and you would have known, maybe you may have not known, that we recently got an award from the Debtors Counseling Association, as one of the best banks that help. And we've been partnering with outside companies, including some companies like Summit, where we take our customers where they can't be assisted through normal processes and we get them to be helped through other processes, get them financial education. So we work quite closely with helping customers. We've set up a fund of 400 million rands, which was intended, again, to say, take a customer who is struggling, who's lost their jobs, who's got dreams and capabilities of doing something, and we help them start and earn an income. Because debt relief, you can reduce debt, or you can help a customer also have income to be able to function, and that's one of the reasons why we've put this together. We've allocated senior resources with NEFSAS to try and find solutions for students who are struggling. As you know, we've got a lot of problems that we've got, and we've dedicated a full-time senior resource to help in that place. And we are putting creative solutions to ease the financial burden by financing poor students. And this is one of the things where we're saying, you know, there's a problem that said you needed to have a rich parent to get a student loan. Nowadays, we find solutions to try and help poor students so that we don't need guarantors. That's really some of the initiatives that we've got going at the moment and that we do on a daily basis. So what is our view then on the potential of legislation of debt relief? We think when you legislate debt relief, it may create some uncertainty in the market, especially for us, and it will slow down some of the initiatives. When we're not sure what's going to happen and we're seeing that we've got legislated rules that are blanket, we will tend to sort of be uncomfortable, and it will worry us and slow down some of our positive initiatives. We also think that it's important that we find solutions for debt relief that avoid loss. I think there has to be a pact between us as organizations, as well as other stakeholders, government, and consumers, where we can find ways of solving things without any legislation. It should be something that's just a moral obligation for us. And so we don't want to do things that increase financial exclusion, especially to the poor in the long run, and increase the cost of borrowing. So because we think that as you put a hard law, especially debt write-off, it will increase a lot of cost and it to the consumer and will create financial exclusion. We also don't want to destroy the culture of repaying back that's legally obtained. We think it's important that that culture is enforced and that customers maintain that culture. We do also think that there's a lot of reckless lending in the market that has happened. And I think that should be dealt within the existing laws, and we should just reinforce those laws. And so we don't need a new law to deal reckless lending. It's just more of a reinforcement thing, and we all need to try and stop those things. We think there's also good existing solutions that maybe we are not utilizing optimally. So if you look at things like debt review, the whole debt review process, there is a lot of inefficiencies there. There's a lot of things that are not working well, and I think we should fix that and make that work better so it solves the customer and it's more accessible to the customer, especially the poor customers. And we think we should adopt the DCRS process and improve it and make sure that it's improved and it's working much better than currently it works. And I think we should continue to engage on indebtedness initiatives and just continue to take some of these initiatives that exist in pockets and different silos and make them much more larger scale and make sure that we can use them much better. And that's what I think we think that we should be doing in this instance. Some of the things that we think will help, though, to make debt relief much easier to work better is we think there's certain data that needs to be much more accessible. So today we don't get to know that a consumer is retrenched or unemployed unless he tells you. But consumers, when they're retrenched and unemployed, they go into a lot of difficulty and they start hiding. And we need to maybe find a way where we can make that data slightly more accessible, and that will be quite helpful so that we can know which consumers to target and help. And we think when someone you've helped and they've gone back to work, it's also hard to know that they've gone back to work. So you help them, but they've gone back to work. You don't know they've gone back to work. It will help to just get that information. And we also think when we're going to put initiatives that especially help students because they're unemployed, again, when they get employed, you want to make sure that once they're employed, then you know that they're now employed. That's something that we think some of the data will help us. also when we do debt relief, it is creating a time, a gap in the collections process. We believe that we shouldn't, that gap shouldn't count in the prescription period, because then if you do debt relief and it leads to debt prescription, it's actually counterintuitive and it actually destroys the process in itself. We think we should have some coordinated education drive between all of us, government and all of us, and so just coordinate some of the education drives for the consumers. And then we think payment prioritization for debts that have been given relief, because the problem is customers take on new debt afterwards, and then payments go to the new debt, but you've given relief on the other side. So that always makes it a bit difficult. And we think there should be a way that when a customer has received debt relief, he is flagged correctly in the bureaus, and everyone can understand that customer has received relief, so they don't just look good, and then other people capitalize and give them debt, some more debt, because that's also counterintuitive. So in conclusion, we definitely support all solutions, initiatives to find solutions for over-indebtedness. But we do believe there's sufficient existing laws and initiatives, but we think they should be leveraged a bit better to address this problem, which we believe exists, and we truly acknowledge that the problem exists. And we think we should make this work a bit more effectively and much more coordinated. And as a bank, we are really committed to a constructive engagement, because we could be committed to fostering the right environment, and we'll do everything and putting our resources behind supporting the initiatives to find any other solution that's sustainable in the long run. So thank you so much, Chair, members.
Thank you very much, then. This is a very succinct presentation, Mr. Ndwandwe. Okay, thank you very much. Now, we're going to enable you to engage with us as an individual bank for 5 to 7 minutes max, and we'll say to members that, you know, let's look at a couple of minutes, because we will be asking the whole group again some of the broader issues. But what I would like you to do, the committee secretary has just informed me, it was very difficult, fair enough, good hope, I mean, I had a lot of maintenance seemed to be going on, but notwithstanding that, it seemed very difficult to hear your responses or the questions. So what we'd like is some, you know, succinct responses backed by written, if that makes sense to everyone. Everyone agreed? Right. So it's over to members, a couple of minutes each. Yes, Honourable Bongani, Honourable Van Skalkwyk, Honourable Kurnoff, Honourable Williams. In that order at the moment. Go ahead.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Firstly, I would like to welcome the presentation from Standard Bank. I'm not going to be discussing now, because I think the overall discussion maybe is going to take place at the end, but I just want clarity on issues before I can formulate my points of discussion. The first one, you spoke about debt consolidation, and then you spoke about selling of debt. I want to know, do you buy debt?
Yeah.
But now, I'm still having another question. Do you buy debt? Because I have points to raise on the question of buying the debt. Two, is around the question of moratorium or holidays on payment. Give me some examples and case studies, because I have a case study on that particular question, which I can discuss it, which is a personal case study. So I want to know, what is your understanding of that particular question and practice in your own institution? Thank you very much.
Right, thank you, Honourable Mkongi. Honourable Van Skalkwyk.
Thank you, Chairperson. I also want to welcome the presentation by Standard Bank. And my two questions that I'm having is, in terms of the 60 staff members that you allocated in this unit, I want to know if you can give us a further breakdown or just elaborate in terms of the geographical placement of these staff members in order to ensure that the services are taken to the people on ground level and to ensure accessibility of all services to our people. And also I want to know, in terms of the wonderful initiatives that you're having, you sold us in terms of what you are doing, but do you have awareness campaigns in place to tell the people what you are actually having, what you are offering in terms of this debt awareness or debt relief initiative to make your services also accessible to all? Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. Standard Bank was privy to the Debt Counselling Association's presentation in front of us on Tuesday. I just want your views on that in general. Do you support that?
Thanks, Chairperson. I've got a couple of questions. Firstly, I'm a little bit sceptical about your need to access the private information of people that are either unemployed or employed. I recently had a problem with one of the banks, but I won't name which one, and I had to go to the National Credit Regulator about information that was actually taken away from me illegally. So I'm a bit sceptical about that. I also want to know, you said that if we did put in place legislation for debt forgiveness, it would create uncertainty. I'd like to know, is there a scenario where some legislation wouldn't create uncertainty? For instance, if we had the bills very specific to a, you know, a group of people, and you knew exactly who was going to get this relief and for how long they were going to get that period, it's a limited period, maybe even once off. I want to know what circumstances would not, for you, create uncertainty. And my last question is, does Standard Bank have a savings campaign where they are promoting savings for South Africans? Because I remember when I was younger, Standard Bank would give out like a little plastic piggy bank and things like that for children to create the savings in, you know, awareness. Because in South Africa, not only are we highly indebted, but nobody's got any savings. And I think the bank should start seriously looking at campaigns to encourage savings with our young people. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Williams. Are there any other questions from the members of the committee? No? Right, can we have just one question from myself, though? Didn't expect it to be finished so quick. It was really on the issue of what you are doing and the debt relief and so on, because I will be interested to hear what you have to say in terms of your views and what we've heard already, because the views we got from BASA, the association, actually was quite negative in terms of that. But you're offering a few other options to us here. And you talk about legislation exists to assist in debt relief. Does that legislation remove the interest? What does it do about the interest itself? And how does it assist? And can it assist you if you're now unemployed with no income? Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Honourable Kongi, the first one is we definitely don't buy debt as an organisation.
Sorry, the secretary's having difficulty hearing you. Can you put your mic down?
Sorry, I'll
and just push it down.
Thank you. We definitely don't buy debt, Honourable Kong. And how we understand and how we do moratoriums is customers come to us and they would say, for example, I have a financial problem right now. I can't pay you for the next 3 months, but my cash flow is going to come in the next 3 months. We then give them a holiday for that 3 months, then we give them a break. Sometimes we've got a customer who's highly indebted. But if you were to give them a 2 to 3 months break in their home loans, which is a massive installment, you can then clear the short-term debt quickly and then continue. So there are moments where we do those things, but again, it's all individual circumstances per customer, and we do it on an individual customer circumstance. And then, Honorable Skatnik, the 60 staff members are situated in head office in Rosebank, in Simon's, unfortunately, in Joburg. But we have a direct call center line which exists, which everyone can access and phone us. We are looking as a bank in general on how do we sort of decentralize some of services geographies like that are sort of remote, but it's always difficult because it becomes quite expensive. But we are trying to work out some solutions around that. The awareness campaigns for customers who are in distress, before we do collections and start collections, we start with an SMS in general, and that tells them what solutions we offer, and we tell them how they can access those solutions in general. So we tell them SMS, we send them letters, so we do communicate quite a lot. We have not been on radio with this communication, but we've done some engagements with different organizations on how we could do it, so we'll work out some of those things over time. And then our views, Honorable Connor, on that counseling presentation, I suppose not everything they presented I fully agree with, but not everything they presented I disagree. There were things that I really think will improve the process, will improve the system. But then there were things where, for example, you start getting into terms that are so long and the dropping of interest to the extremes can cause a bit more problems with fair value adjustment of debt and will create a circular reference, you know, that we don't want to have. So I think there were some good points, but there were things that we don't sort of quite agree with. And then Honorable Williams, on the issue of accessing data, it's honestly, this case is just, we would like to know if someone is retrenched so that we can help them, and specifically our customers, so that we would help them. How, you know, we control it and how we protect the data, I suppose it will fall under the normal rules of POPI and making sure that we don't use it for unintended consequences, purposes. And this uncertainty point, it's, unfortunately, in general, it's very hard to legislate nuanced situations without creating uncertainty. Because the problem is, once you do a blanket rule, it then doesn't solve for the nuances that you get in general. Because there's so many nuances in over indebtedness that you want to sort of solve for, and that's really what we're trying to say with that test statement. And then savings campaign, I'm quite proud that I'm standing here on probably the week just after we've launched our kids app, and I'm sure you've heard our kids on radio. We've been actually started that, so there's a lot of that info that's going around. So probably my timing is quite right. We've not been good at it, to be honest, but we're now doing it quite a lot of that. Chair, I suppose maybe on the views of BASA, we contributed with BASA. We contributed the presentation with BASA. Maybe there might be a view that we were coming across negatively, but the intention was never to come across negatively. The intention was to try and create awareness of what we think are some of the issues that will come from legislating this. If we did come across negatively as BASA, and we are members of BASA, we do apologize. And then, sorry, the chair, you asked me about the legislation interest. When you apply debt review, there are instances where you drop interest. Sorry, apologies. There are instances where you do drop interest. So there are many sort of times in debt review where we've dropped a lot of interest for many customers. In fact, we do a lot of margin drop, especially in unsecured debt. Chair.
Thank you very much for that input. But do you want a quick follow up?
All right. Look,
come back at the end, you know, when we're asking everyone. You're not disappearing right now, are you, Mr. Ndwandwe? But maybe try a mic in front. All right. But let's try the mic in front. In front. We're going to proceed, but at the end I said we still have everyone to check with. All right, keep that question. Okay, now we want to engage directly, let's see, with APSA. Is it APSA? APSA? Thank you very much. And thank you for the very swift turnaround. That's what we need. Swift turnaround. And from APSA Bank, we have Mr. Fox. Mr. Fox, is that yourself? And that's all I've got down here. Don't have any other. This is not good enough. We have to record. you, I look, that one's working down there. Ms. Makanda, can you just go and switch that mic off, please? And Advocate van der Merwe, can you try switching on?
Madam Chair, I also have Jan Muganma with me. He is the Chief Executive of the Personal and Business Bank Customer Solutions side.
Thank you very much. And that's yourself then, is it? Because we don't have it here, and you'll perhaps fill it in.
That's right. Thank you.
Yeah. All right, do go ahead.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair, and thanks to members of the committee. I'm going to give a context over about two pages and then hand over to Mr. Fox, who is the Chief Risk Officer of the Retail and Business Banking. And maybe just outright, I also would like to acknowledge the ongoing support we get from the National Credit Regulator's Office. Because outside of these engagements in the committee, those regular engagements help us a lot in guiding the things we do to improve the lives of people in the country. The first page talks to appreciation for this opportunity to engage with the committee. And we want to put it up outright that we fully support the need to do responsible lending and to worry about indebted customers and how all of us can contribute towards solving that as a challenge. And we want to also stress that we think the NCA as regulation has done a lot for the industry in terms of improving the practices and how, you know, customers are treated in the process. And for us as APSA, this is more than just about regulation. We just think it is a responsible way of doing business. So legislation aside, we think it is a responsible way of doing business. Our mission is to, and purpose is to help people achieve their ambitions the right way. We want to stress the right way because we think banking is a risk management business primarily. As many of the members and the chair will appreciate this more than maybe even many of us do, the business is simple. It's the business of taking money from depositors and giving them to people who would return it over time so that when depositors require those funds are available. So risk management is at the core of our business. The rest of the presentation covers the general context that we think is important for this discussion. And Mr. Fox will touch on the measures we take, both regulated and non-regulated. We'll also outline the benefits of the current debt review measures and the key criteria we apply in helping customers who are indebted. I'm going to spend a few minutes on the next slide, which gives a context, because we want to make sure that the context is understood so the rest of our discussion is seen within that context. There is clarity on how what is reckless lending and how it is dealt, so we want to put upright that that's not what we are discussing here, because where there is a case of reckless lending, legislation is very clear on how that's dealt. So that's not what we are discussing here, and the discussion here is largely around relief, and relief as part of a legally binding contract. The clear intent from us, an organization, is on responsible lending, balancing, continue to strike balance towards securing the funds of the depositors, but enable the customers, you know, fund the prosperity of customers who may not have funds readily available to do that, whether it is for education, for housing, and for mobility requirements. I stressed up front that our business is that of risk management, so you will see that there is enough, more than enough oversight, not only a number of regulations that govern banking, but the key oversight of the National Credit Regulator and the Reserve Bank. And our, part of our concerns is that just as much as there is more and more tightening of regulation to improve this responsible lending, we have to be careful that additional measures don't drive customers in unregulated spaces. And that's really one of our, the concerns we want to put up front. The outcome of all of this is, as we continue to fund people's lifestyles and aspirations, is we will always have performing loans, so where customers continue to honor their obligations, and we'll have non-performing loans. But all of those have been factored in the models that we use to do the credit decisions. The only caution there is because those decisions have already been made for customers who we have lent to now already, to change in the middle of that and say, let's give them additional debt relief other than what is already catered for in the legislation, changes the basis on which the risk would have been assessed at the time of doing the lending. I want to point out that in Absa's case, at this point in time, 95% of loans are up to date. So we think it's a reflection of responsible lending. So what we are talking about here falls in the 5% of the loans that Absa issued. There are a number of relief measures. As I said, we think there is enough measures catered for in the National Credit Act, including the subsequent amendments. There is more we all can do in promoting awareness, though. So just as much as there is measures in the regulation, the volumes do not suggest that there is enough awareness at options available to customers who are indebted. So Absa is committed to do more in terms of promoting awareness of the measures. And then there are other measures that are not part of the regulation. So I'm going to hand over to Mr. Fox to talk about the regulated and non-regulated measures that Absa takes.
Thank you. So APSA provides more than just the legislated debt relief measures, and you know, at the end we'll recommend that, you know, as an outcome we must preserve the mix of credit provider specific and regulated measures, because both of them have unique benefits, and retaining the mix, I think, you know, preserves the benefits of both, gets us to best of both, and also I think provides more opportunities for customers and options to customers to choose from at the end of the day to find a solution that really works for their circumstances. So when I refer to benefits on the regulated side provided for in the NCA, the benefits of regulated measures comes around things like providing a standard approach across the industry, It obviously can be monitored by regulators and therefore enforced, and allows for coordination across the industry, particularly where a borrower has a relationship with multiple credit providers. However, it does not cater for customer unique circumstances. So where that is not necessarily the best solution, credit provider specific solutions can add a lot of value. In that space, there's clear commercial incentive to find workable solutions. If a credit provider can find a measure that works better than anybody else's in terms of helping indebted, performing loans will be higher, and therefore, you know, your profitability should be better. So there's clear incentive to come up with options, and therefore promotes innovation. And that innovation is often copied very quickly, and also provides, I think, a factory for ideas that if they show great potential, can feed future standards and or legislation if they are proven to work. So again, that mix is quite important. And I think flexibility, so it allows for the bespoke sort of solutions based on specific customer needs where standard rule-driven approach potentially does not. And again, if both options are available to consumers, then you know we should be able to find something that works. On the left, I list a number of the practices we currently offer. I won't take time to go through all of them in detail. Happy to take questions on them. These are things that we currently offer to our customers to try and resolve their financial difficulty. But maybe importantly, just at the bottom there, to point out that we do not subscribe to emolument attachment orders. So in that space, the way it works is that we continuously roll out challenger strategies, alternatives to what's in place, to see whether they can outperform what we have, and if they do, you know, those become sort of the champion solutions, and so that innovation and progression continues. On the regulated side, debt review is good legislation in our view. It's got incredible potential. However, there's a couple of barriers or obstacles that doesn't let it fulfill its promise. Some of them, in our view, is the whole issue of education and awareness. That's come through in a number of presentations where consumers, when they find themselves in financial difficulty, either don't know, are afraid, or scared, or embarrassed, and we need to drive education, not as a bank only, but as an industry, to get customers comfortable. It's always better to come up quicker and deal with the issue sooner than sitting on your problem for longer. It just makes it worse. Some adoption barriers was mentioned, and we support this as an issue. It's largely driven by legal costs and then turnaround times in the process. Ideas like voluntary is things I think we should explore. There was attempts made by the industry which didn't come to fruition. I think the intent was pure. I guess you know maybe that can be relooked and see if whatever stopped from going ahead can be solved or not. There's some process inefficiencies, and we do think that the DCRA system that was covered in previous sessions and the adoption thereof, which is making great progress in industry level with the NCR as outlined by previous speakers, you know, will do a lot in terms of efficiency given the fact that concessions are pre-agreed. You don't have to go around with the banks and find solutions. You can just run it through and see if it works. Non-NCA debt is legislatively not included, although debt councillors do take it into account when they try and formulate plans. That is something maybe that could be looked at administratively. And those are things like municipal bills, subscriptions, and those type of obligations that still play into the cash flow calculation that needs to be done, but it's not specifically covered in the Act. Maximum solve term does not allow for customer-specific requirements. I think the Debt Counseling Association recommended on Tuesday to push the 5 years to the 7 years. That could be an option, but I don't think it solves the problem. Maybe it gives you more time, because at 7 years, you're still going to have customers that need 12 and others need 5, but I think that is where you can then fall to the left-hand side of the page around bespoke arrangement plans that, you know, if we need to solve on 13 years, we can do it. It doesn't have to go through the regulated relief measure. It can go to the unregulated one that sort of aims to achieve the same thing. There's currently no incentive in the debt review other than rehabilitation. So I think, can we add something? Certainly on the left-hand side, we do offer incentives other than just getting rehabilitated and a good credit record. And there I talk around settlement discount offers and that sort of thing. So it is offered in the unregulated space. And then no real-time update of the debt counseling status at the credit bureaus, which leads to the examples given. How can somebody be granted credit or apply for credit, be granted that,
when they've applied for debt counselling. The reason for that is there's delays and incompleteness in the bureau data, so when a credit provider looks it up, they can't see that this customer has actually applied for debt counselling because it hasn't been listed on the bureau due to process efficiencies and those sort of things that can be cleaned up. And then in Duplum and prescription are further relief measures which play a particular role. So we think the current legislation is good. It covers a lot of bases. It's got great potential, but it's not fully optimized yet. And maybe we must give it a proper go first before we introduce further legislation and see if it actually can deliver what it promised. In terms of criteria, we've not listed specific criteria. What we prefer to present is whatever criteria is decided upon, it should align to certain principles that guide the setting of those criteria. And what we propose is that essentially comes down to two principles. It's around willingness and ability to pay. If a customer is not willing, doesn't have a willingness to pay, it's very difficult to try and find a solution. That's very different to the ability to pay. If there's a willingness to pay, it opens the door for the opportunity for a solution. The solution then is determined by whether the ability to pay. Clearly, if somebody has no income, no assets, they have no ability to pay, and therefore this measure we propose must take that into account. Where a customer is willing to pay, but have very little ability, again, there is some ability to pay, and the measure should take that into account. So we believe as long as the criteria, you know, deal with willingness and ability to pay, it would be fine, and that should be regardless of industry or other groupings that could interpret it as preferential. So no matter which industry you are in, if you are willing to pay but you're not able to, you should enjoy equal benefit of the measure. At the same time, it should also be regardless of type or term of debt. So whether you are in financial difficulty and trying to solve for a 2-year personal loan or trying to solve for a 20-year mortgage, the criteria shouldn't treat you differently. The solution should not treat you differently. It should still entitle you to relief measures. The actual relief measure and the solution out of the whole suite of options should take into account the product and the term to find a workable solution, you know, because it's unique circumstances. It should have the ability to deal with circumstances, changes in circumstances. So when we apply the measure up front, it's on a set of facts. If those facts change, either your financial position deteriorates or improves, then you know it should be able to adjust for that as circumstances change. It's not a point in time and you live with it for life. I think maybe some things to try and avoid in terms of unintended consequences. The criteria should not impact on consumers not requiring debt relief, to some of the points that Mr. Muganwa made. So it should not put risk on depositor funds and introduce any financial stability issues within the financial system. It should not introduce incremental costs of credit, and it should not cause restrictions of accessibility to credit. So overall, we support our debt relief measures that are sustainable, and I think that's quite critical. Again, to some of the questions to Mr. Ndwandwe around what introduces uncertainty, I think sustainability does not introduce because you can plan for it. Ad hoc, once-off sort of approaches does because you don't know what it's going to do. It's easier to plan for something that you know is going to work. And then I think around the question of of the impact, very difficult to quantify, but we believe that if we just take a look at what's happening on debt counselling, so despite all the inefficiencies and issues that I've highlighted, on our book we've got about 8 billion of loans on debt counselling and growing, which we see as a positive. People are starting to use it. We also see more people applying for debt counselling in when they are even still in order or up to date, but they foresee a problem. Where initially when it started, a lot of the applications were they 4, 5, 6 installments down as a really last resort. So I think that is progress and that needs to be accelerated so people more proactively highlight the issues. So we've got 8 billion. On that we see roughly a 60% agreement rate. So on 60% of the cases, despite the issues, we do find a solution. And on that 60%, about 80% payment rate, so people are able to hold to that. So if that is possible despite these issues, if we sort out the process and inefficiencies and make those barriers go away, you know, the scale and the speed in that process, you know, can grow exponentially and have a significant impact on the industry. Thank you.
Thank you to both of the members from Standard Bank, that is Jan, was it APSA, Jan Mahanwa and Mr. Kobe. This was it. Right. Now, just quick engagement on critical issues from members. Try to keep your question short. Yes, Honourable Williams, Honourable Hill Lewis, Honourable MacPherson. Okay, on that note, Honourable Honourable Mkongi.
Thank you, Chair. I've just got one question. It's regarding risk. You said you were risk managing risk, and I just want to know what risk does the bank take when somebody has a mortgage and they default after 18 years because of retrenchments, then their house gets sold and it gets sold for less money than they owe, and then they still have to pay back the money that they owe you. So I want to know where your risk is, because you charge us interest, you charge the people interest to cover that risk, but it seems that you don't actually take any risk at all. You know, so I want to know exactly how that works. Thank you.
Williams, Honourable Mkongi, Lewis at this point, thank you, do come in.
Thank you very much. Two questions. Do you incentivise your sales agents to cross-sell debt consolidation products? And if you could give us the details in that regard. I'm interested because obviously the interest on personal loans, which most of your debt consolidation products are obviously much higher than on some other loan products which they may be consolidating, which may, while it's administratively simpler for the customer to pay one payment each month, be more expensive for them if they are paying a higher interest rate across the combined debt. That's the first question. The second question is, you know, all of the banks, and admittedly to a slightly lesser extent according to the figures provided to us by the NCR from APSA, but all of the banks still aggressively market unsecured credit via your ATMs, for example, where you can, on most of the bank's ATMs, one can obtain a loan directly from the ATM, or at least apply for one. And on your website and via SMS and via monthly post communication, and it's very aggressively sold. Can you give us some indication of how your sales figures have changed over the last 2 to 3 years on unsecured credit in particular?
Thank you, Honourable Hill Lewis. Honourable Mkongi.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Now I have a few questions. I also want to stress on issues of risk management, because your argument is that you are supposed to be protecting the depositors, that they must get return in their own deposits when they want them. Now, I want to ask whether this principle is also the same principle that you apply when firms want credit for a cost of capital, and what is the criteria that you use there? Because, for an example, some of the depositors becomes consumers, people who work and save their money in the bank. You take that money and give it to firms to fund their cost of capital. Now, what is the criteria that you give into big firms? Because at the end of the day, some of these firms can go down and be liquidated, and they are a risk to you. So in terms of that management, I want to understand, how do you deal with the credit for funding the cost of capital and relation to the risk? The last question, Chairperson. In your own risk management strategy, you don't plan for short run and long term, and long run risk management. Because I'm asking this question because you raised the question that is saying current debt risk management, that is NCA, you have already made some arrangement, let's say to some of the individuals for debt relief. And then in future, if this act is becoming enacted, it can impact on that. So I'm just trying to check you in your planning, whether in terms of the risk management strategy, do you plan a short-term run or in the long-term run in order to mitigate such issues? Thank you.
Thank you very much. Would you please respond to this, whoever wishes to in the team, please?
Thank you. So firstly, on mortgages and secured lending, I think it's a question that came up on Tuesday as well, and the risk around mortgages. So I think the difference between secured lending and unsecured lending is that there's obviously collateral. But having collateral itself doesn't take risk away. So you've got customer risk. So what is the risk on a customer's ability to pay? And then on the secured side, what it does give you is some better risk protection than an unsecured because, yes, at the end of the day, you can realize an asset to offset your debt. But collateral risk is not zero. And the reasons for that is when you grant a mortgage loan up front, there's a loan-to-value calculation. And that depends on the amount of the deposit you can put down. So if you can put down zero deposit, the loan-to-value is 100%. Right? It's a full loan. If you can put on a deposit of, let's say, 30%, the loan-to-value is 70%. Now, clearly, the bigger the deposit, the lower the collateral risk by default. So if we take a loan, 100% loan, the value of the property can come down faster than what the outstanding amount comes down due to things like neglect, no maintenance being done, a specific area, property values dropping because of various social factors. So there are risks in that the value of the property will drop faster than what the outstanding amount is. And that becomes very real where loan-to-values are above 90% when you grant them. To give you a sense of the industry, more than 40% of the demand for mortgages sit in loan-to-values of more than 90%. So more than 40% of customers that apply for mortgages can't put down a deposit of more than 10%. All right, so we've got to balance that risk out with trying to realize customers' ambitions of owning a home and putting them in a house and put that in. So that risk is then quantified and applied and is introduced as a risk premium on the pricing, which I think was one of the questions on Tuesday. So that sort of explains why we do have a risk. The question on why do we sell, the question on valuation or property values when we do a sale in execution, I think is a critical one. Obviously, there was some news coverage. And there's two ways we go about it. We offer, again, on the two solutions. We've got an in-house or a credit-specific solution called Help You Sell, which is trying to work with customers before it gets into the legal regulated sale in execution process. And there we work with customers to introduce them to estate agents, support them through the process. If there's a shortfall against what the property is realized versus what is outstanding, we give discounts on that or we forfeit some of that. So let's try to solve for the customer before it gets into the legislated. What we see from that is that the values we realize through that process is a lot higher than what we realize in a sale and execution process. So we try and encourage that and we see good results there. When it gets to sale and execution, it's obviously an auction process and that's introduced third parties, sheriffs of the courts and that sort of thing. Comments were raised on Tuesday around collusion in that industry. So we've taken a number of measures to try and combat any collusion, either from our own staff or from the third parties that get involved in that process. So simple things like we put a reserve price down. So if the property value that is achieved in the sale execution is below what we think is right, we would buy that property back at the auction. And rather own it ourselves and put it up for auction later where we can get a better price, which is better for us, better for the customer. So things like disclosing our reserve price to the auctioneer previously was an issue. So now we make that only available at the last minute. So there can be no manipulation, say, look, the bank has is going to buy it at this value and therefore you need to tender at that price and work around that price. You know, so there's tactical measures like that to optimize that process as well. Because I think there's always the risk that in those processes, it's open for abuse by various people. At the end of the day, we want to get a realistic price for the property. We offer multiple solutions, trying to close the gaps in the process that open it for abuse. But if the property sells for less than what's outstanding, there's a shortfall, and then we need to try and deal with that through our own process. you know, we try and eat some of that or share some of that shortfall with customers because we tend to get a better price for the process. It's a lot more proactive. It's a lot earlier in the process. And the customer's a voluntary participant in that. I mean, a lot of them don't understand the process, so assisting them, introducing them to estate agents and proper process gets a better result than a sale and execution process. In terms of incentives to sell debt counselling, as far as I know, we don't sell debt consolidation actively, and there's no incentives for selling it. My personal view on debt consolidation, I think I share some of the concerns. Same with balance transfers, I think is a bigger issue. We definitely don't do balance transfers because I think it just moves the debt around, and the smart customers will just move their debt around and work the system instead of addressing the problem. It creates a dangerous culture. So debt consolidation can work. I think if you offer it to your own customers where they've got multiple debts with you, so like a personal home loan, but I agree that it should be a better deal than the loans individually. You know, it should be a synergistic product which gives you a better outcome. Otherwise, you know, that doesn't make any sense. In terms of marketing unsecured lending, let's talk personal loans specifically, which I think is where the question is aimed at. About 6 years ago, Mr. Mangano can keep me honest here, but about 6 years odd ago, I think we were the second largest market share in personal loans. We aggressively pulled that back. I think today we are sixth in terms of market share. So we've actively, on the steer of our board, reduced our appetite for loans. Our strategy today on loans is that it's largely aimed at existing customers, people who bank with us, put their salary with us. We have very little in terms of the board sets risks, mandate and scales to control concentration risk. We've got little if no open market mandate, i.e. selling personal loans to customers that don't bank with us. And it's tied into a broader proposition where we want primary customers to bank with us, and on the back of that banking, you know, we will provide lending because we've got a good relationship with you, we can see your income, and it gets better risk outcome at the end of the day as well. I'll just quickly short-term, long-term, and then hand over to Magara to deal with the question of Honourable Konki. We plan short and long-term. We've got a short-term plan, medium-term plan, where we need to optimise both. You know, so I don't know if that answers the question, but if I understood you correctly, some of the credit-specific relief measures potentially drop into legislation, that's okay. If it adds value, it doesn't take away the measure from us and the customer, just puts it into a different space. So if we don't lose value in that process, if it adds value to the industry and the process doesn't take anything away from a competitive advantage point of view, obviously, you know, we would encourage that. So what that means is that it just creates space for us to come up with new things, which is my earlier point around stimulating innovation of things. Let us test things at a scale, and if it really works, perhaps it will just be competitively adopted, either competitively or in a standard, or if it has to be legislated, maybe, but if it works, normally it doesn't have to be legislated. Thank you.
I'll just touch briefly on the two questions. So, I'll use 1 minute of that, Chair. Thank you. The first one is on lending to businesses. In fact, we apply the same strict criteria on affordability. Now, even though the NCA was largely focused on protecting individuals and very small businesses, we apply the same strict criteria because our responsibility on managing, you know, the risk related to depositors' funds remains. In fact, Honourable Member, you'll understand that's probably one of the reasons why SME lending is still one of the big issues in the country, because many of these businesses, all they have is projections for where they believe they are taking their businesses, but we cannot see evidence of generating money and their ability to pay, and it's one of the challenges, not for the discussion today, that we have to think about how to solve for that. Other countries have found more creative ways of doing that, but today we still apply the same strict rules on their ability to repay. And the other question was on, you know, short-term versus long-term view. You know, some of our products force us, we take a long-term view. You know, mortgage bonds are over 20 years. They've been now getting to 25 years, 30 years, which is really one of the reasons why certainty is required. Because some of the decisions we are talking about today, those decisions were made with a view of how things, an attempt of having a view of how things will pan out over 20 to 25, 30 years. It is very difficult to, in the middle of the process, get a surprise intervention that you didn't cater for at the time of making a decision. It always has to be a long-term view.
No, thank you very much. What we are going to do, Honourable Hill Lewis, just a moment, we have some good news. There won't be divisions, you know, so that certainly is a help, isn't it? I want a brief question, and as I said, even to the Honourable Oliphant, it can come back in writing. Yes, Honourable Hill Lewis?
Yes, thank you for your explanation on sales and execution. When you started to discuss the shortfall, though, you started to become a little bit predictably vague, I'm afraid. This is the kind of answer we often get from banks. You say that you share the shortfall with customers. Can you give us the details in that regard, how exactly you share the shortfall with customers? And I think the point being made is that I perfectly understand loan-to-value, but you recover, if I understand it correctly, if in fact you don't share the shortfall and you expect the customer to cover the shortfall, then the only risk that you take on is the legal fees and sale and execution fees and sharers fees, which as a percentage of the total LTV is a few decimals. So I repeat the question, where exactly is the risk? Because you're charging the customer risk premium for the collateral loss which you've outlined, but there is no collateral loss. Because unless you share the shortfall, where's the collateral loss?
You're going to come back on that one because I also have a question and we'll see how time goes with all of us. You did make it very clear that the risk involved, whether it was even secured debt, etc., was still risky. Now, I just want a very quick, clear answer, and you can even give me this back in writing. Are you saying, because this is what it sounded like, you have never sold a house that you have repossessed, as it were, on the open market for less than 50% of its value? No? I want a yes and a no, and if it is a yes or a no, you will then put that, the reasons for that, in writing. Thank you.
Firstly, to Honourable Hill Lewis, I think so. Where we agree, and it's not a general rule in our help you sell process, which is not a sales and execution. That's our in-house solution. In that process, we would, at times, depending on the situation and in the negotiation with the customer, agree to take a share of the shortfall. That will differ by customer, whether it applies or not, and the extent thereof. So we encourage customers to take it up, and in the process we can have a negotiation and see where it lands. It does not apply into the sales and execution process, which is the legislated process. In the legislated process, when there's a shortfall, that amount is still due by the customer, but it's still due. Until it's paid, we still at risk for that amount. Now, whether that customer is willing or not willing, but let's say willing and unable to pay, and that's very likely, because otherwise they wouldn't end up in that situation to start with, and they can't pay, that debt can prescribe. And if it prescribes, that loss realizes. So even though the customer remains liable for the amount, doesn't mean they're going to get paid for it. And we often don't. And that risk realizes on us. In terms of your question?
Yes or no, and then come back in writing.
So the answer is yes, and it was also broadly covered in the media, and we'll respond accordingly.
It would appear as if some of the responses that have been given were constrained by time. So if you would back it up with written responses as well, because I know you'd like to expand more on the matter. The other issue which you need to respond to in writing, do you make loans to the unemployed clients? No, in writing, thank you. Thank you. All right. Now, I'd like to thank you, Mr. Fox. So you are going to come back to us. Mr. Hermans was looking at responses by Monday, was it? You know, from all of you in that regard. So if you need more time, you will communicate with Mr. Hermans. But I want to thank you both. Thank you. And then we're going to take two at a time. We're going to be looking at Nedbank and African Bank. We'll start off with Nedbank. Mr. Desai, Head of Credit, Nedbank Retail and Business Lending. Right. Some of you were already present, if not all of you, on Tuesday, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, we were, Chair. Thank you. May I start? So good afternoon, Honourable Chairperson and Honourable members of this committee and the rest of the participants in this portfolio committee session. We thank you for the opportunity to come and talk about our thoughts around this very important matter, and we do understand the pressures that are generally in the system around this very sensitive issue. I think upfront, let me just state you know, what philosophy guides our business practices. And I've certainly quoted a statement from our chief executive, Mr. Brown, around what he would expect from all of us in Nedbank. And I'll kind of highlight that if it's our wish to be Africa's most admired bank, then we can only do that if we align what is good for South Africa, is good for our clients, and is good for Nedbank. Then we are on our way to being Africa's most admired bank. And as I talk to the presentation, hopefully you will see where we kind of live up to that vision. So I think it's also important just to maybe put into perspective what Nedbank looks like. And so we are a full-spectrum bank, commercial bank in South Africa, having total loans of about 693 billion, of which 224 is to consumers and to small businesses. And we have about 7.7 million clients in total across the bank and across the continent. And in 2015, we granted about 57 billion worth of loans to consumers, most of which was in home loans and vehicle finance. We also kind of give graphically some perspectives around our growth and in relation to our focus areas, you know, the scale of personal loans. And if you look at the bottom right graph in terms of advances, distributions, or loan distributions, you'll see that largely we are a secured lending bank with relatively smaller portfolios in credit cards and personal loans. In personal loans, you'll also notice that certainly between 2014 and 2015, we had a negative growth rate in personal loans because we had pulled back a number of years ago, evidencing the risk. If I talk about our approach to lending, I think we essentially rely on three pillars that guide us. One is the credit policies that we would have derived over the years and had experience of. The affordability rules, which obviously ever since NCA came in 2006, so this is its 10th year as such, and obviously the update we had last year around affordability rules, and then the scorecards, that on balance, the combination of all three allows for us a comprehensive and robust credit assessment, which we believe satisfies the requirements of both the main regulators we have in this field, which is the National Credit Regulator and the South African Reserve Bank. Our success in retail lending,
performance-wise is a result of our robust governance systems and commitment to portfolio quality. And here we have properly constituted and independently chaired credit committees for each of our loan portfolios, which in addition to just monitoring metrics of credit quality, also keeps a very strong focus on whether we comply with our obligations in this act. So, you know, we certainly pride ourselves on how we monitor this, we track this, and certainly in our engagement with the regulators, we tend to convey some of what we do. Modeling standards as well are regularly improved. As data quality improves, the predictiveness of models increases, and, you know, we have a twice a year certainly calibration of models as well as our policies and affordability rules. We are also an active participant in all the industry discussions, and we closely interact with regulators in this regard and proactively suggest how lending practices could improve. If I then talk about our approach to debt relief, so we are aware, and the statistics are obviously always out there in the media, that just less than half of SA's credit active consumers have some form of impaired credit record. And it's been relatively consistently high for the last 3 years. It has been improving of late, but we know that it's fairly high. And, you know, lending is not kind of a new thing, certainly for the major banks. And if I talk about NetBank in particular, you know, we have been governed by acts for a long time, Credit Agreements Act, UCD, Magistrates Court, Banks Act, which has constantly been changing as each Basel Committee update comes through, and obviously National Credit Act. And we also obviously want to make sure that we give consumers a fair chance to repay their debts and recognizing that they may be in trouble. And so at any point in time across the credit life cycle, the consumers are free to approach us to seek equitable debt relief measures. And where we proactively identify certain pressure points, we do approach them. So overall philosophy in collections is to try and rehabilitate the client. We need to be conscious that South Africa is a very low GDP growth country, and as such, the pool of customers is more or less static. And therefore, what we cannot obviously afford is large portions of the credit active population reducing. So we need to try and keep them in shape, educate them at the same time, and allow them to repay their debts. So we try and avoid hard legal collections as much as possible. And over the following slides, I'll try and illustrate some of that. We've been very proactive, especially when we foresee that there are maybe problematic industries that are emerging. So certainly if I take mining and steel as an example, we were fairly proactive in identifying those clients who work in those industries, who are banking with us, and then approaching them. To say, well, you know, what can we do? Are you in difficulties? And we have an active department, collections department, across our business that proactively looks at this. I then want to try and address some of the specific questions that were given to us. So if you look at debt relief initiatives that are provided for in NCA or other legislation, I think we've talked about debt counseling, as are my other colleagues from the bank, so I won't talk much about that. Mm-hmm. Prescription is an important one, and certainly last year, the tightening of rules around prescription, I think you need to look at as a form of debt relief that was given. The affordability assessment regulations themselves, in a sense, act as a brake on future owing indebtedness. Credit life also provided for in the regulations acts as a good debt relief mechanism. Induplum is an interesting one, as we do know that there isn't legal clarity yet on this in terms of one interpretation. We certainly proposed an interpretation to the regulator, and then which we proceeded to effect, and we monitor this closely every month, that nobody's, you know, none of our clients are kind of crossing the Induplum cap. And, you know, I'm happy to say that, you know, it's fairly well under control. Then we've make reference to the Magistrates Court Act, the Insolvency Act. You know, suffice to say that these are obviously expensive processes. In terms of debt relief initiatives that are over and above the NCA, so if we take debt counseling, and the debt counseling rule systems that the industry developed, I think is an excellent rule set. Other banks have talked about this. And as we've stated previously, that you know some of the concessions here can go to as low as 0% interest for the period that the client would be in debt counseling. And in terms of NetBank's own figures, you know, we have an 87% approval rate via DCRS. So to the extent that somebody's debt review application has come via the DCRS rule set, you know, 87% of those we approve, versus 66% for the purely statutory process where debt counseling organizations have not opted to use that particular rule set. So we certainly would say that DCRS is something that must be supported actively and where possible enhanced. I'll also talk about the voluntary debt mediation service. You know, suffice to say, I think initially that it looks like there's been still quite a lot of misunderstanding around it. I was involved in the discussions at that time. Its biggest benefit was going to be that the participating credit providers were going to create an institutional mechanism and an institution staffed with the call center systems and all of that to proactively offer debt mediation services to clients at no charge to consumers. And as we know that in the statutory process, our biggest drawback is what happens to poorer customers. So I would certainly strongly encourage that we reopen this discussion, and whatever concerns are there, we address it via proper discussions amongst participants. In terms of consumer education, I think, you know, there are some noteworthy things that we've done as an industry and certainly as NetBank as well. So a couple of years ago, we prepared standardized industry material for consumer education that we wanted to use at each stage of the credit life cycle, where the customer is maximum engaged with the process, and with a view to try and affect the customer's decision-making in the sense that he decides and his eyes are fully open in terms of going into certain agreements. And we're busy as NetBank implementing that. Then in terms of the voluntary debt relief measures that we as NetBank offer. So arrangements is a very well-known collections technique where we try and for the short term, 2-3 months or 4 months, try and rework an alternative payment plan so that allows a client to catch up. Debt consolidation in terms of consolidating loan agreements into one agreement with a better interest rate overall. Freeze of payments for an agreed period. So for example, for maternity leave, or provide a grace period for retrenchment or the unemployed or recently unemployed, we do offer that. We also stop legal action under circumstances where the balance outstanding versus capital borrowed is, so for example, in some of the examples I've heard that if it was a million rand loan, but 10,000 is left, you know, what do we do? So, you know, we certainly have a solution around that. Child-headed household as well, which is disease estate as such, you know, we do suspend and stop legal action there. And then certainly when we notice that there are strikes, so when we see that there is some strikes in some industry, we again identify that particular client set and suspend legal action, because we know again that it's not something that you know, necessarily the consumers created on their own. Restructures is a very big solution that we use. So it could be rescheduling of home loans or rescheduling of car loans. And certainly, you know, we're very proud of this. We put this in our sustainability report every year, in our annual report. And we've kept more than 30,000 of our clients stay in their homes over the last 4 or 5 years. And then even in vehicle finance, more than 200,000 clients experiencing financial challenges, we have restructured their accounts so they can keep their car. Because we recognize that in South Africa, driving your own car to work is still a key requirement. And then in terms of assisted sales, again, where the client is willing to in the first instance, except his or her financial circumstances have changed, is willing to downsize his or her home, we certainly engage into a voluntary sale process with him, and marketing the property is not a distressed asset. That's very important, which means they'll get a better price for their house, and thereby reducing their outstanding. And certainly up to date, about 3,800 clients have benefited from this. And you know, we're quite happy that about 400 million of indebtedness for those particular clients was reduced over the last 3 or 4 years. In terms of criteria informing debt relief, which was a particular question again from the committee, so when we design bespoke solutions for each distressed client, we take a number of factors into account. You know, employment and income situation. Is it a loss of employment? Is it a salary reduction? What is it? Industry-specific factors I've alluded to, like strikes or steel. What's the reason for non-payment? So is it a willingness issue or an ability issue that you would have heard before? How long is the remaining term? So is it 2 months, 3 months, or is it 10 years of a 20-year mortgage? What's the conduct of the account? Again, historically, has the client repaid us in good faith? Is a factor we would look at. Amount of the overdue position, so is he 3 months down, 6 months missed payments? And then obviously availability of credit insurance in case of retrenchment. And I think the point around this is to say that there's so many factors. It's difficult to set a one-size-fits-all criteria here. So we, in each case, case by case, we try and answer these questions. In terms of duration type and manner of debt relief measures, certainly the short-term ones are arrangements, but restructures, assisted sales are more long-term in nature in terms of its solution set. So I think in conclusion, from a Nedbank perspective, we certainly recognize that the high level of indebtedness is of primary concern to society in general, and I think certainly Parliament and to Nedbank as well. We need to recognize that lending is a mutually beneficial contract, both legal and social, between a credit provider and a consumer. And if managed responsibly, obviously assists the financial stability of banks as such, you know, financially enhances the client's own standing over time as he repays the loan, and also the economy and society at large. And you know, our philosophy and how we do business has actually helped us, and it's demonstrated in our performance, where as at 31st December, only 4.6% of our consumers were classified as in default, meaning three payments or more down. And so this reflects our prudent lending stance, and as far as distressed clients are concerned, the kind of bespoke solutions that we try and work out for our clients. So we certainly view that it would be improper and unfair to penalize responsible credit providers who have demonstrated a sound lending practice with a one-size-fits-all debt forgiveness strategy. We certainly believe that it would, you know, we certainly look forward for the subcommittee to have detailed understandings of some of this, you know, from each bank, and then make an assessment whether a one-size-fits-all forgiveness mechanism is required. So I think with that, I rest my presentation. Thank you.
So really, we would like to thank you very much, you and your colleague who's there, Mr. Desai. Thank you. And a very succinct presentation, but of course I know members may wish to engage. Let's do that rather quickly. Honourable Hill Lewis, Honourable, I did say to you, but the time is good. Honourable Kurinoff, is Honourable Van Schalkwijk, Honourable Williams, Honourable Hilda.
Yes, a very quick question. Thank you, sir. Do you refer distressed customers to debt counsellors?
Yes, it is part of our counselling strategy, depending on how far or how down they are. But we do, yes.
Chairperson, thank you very much. When you do an arrangement or debt consolidation with a client and you put it into what you say a single agreement, and then you must say you charge a lower interest rate. That's good news to hear that. But would it be interest on interest? So you will capitalize the amount, it become a new capital amount, and then hopefully you charge a lower interest. Or will you write off some of the interest and then have the same capital amount originally and then just have a new single agreement?
Should I answer that?
No, we've got another question, another input. I think it's yourself, isn't it, Honourable Van Schalkwyk?
Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. I'm also interested in the freezing of payments. I know that clients that's taking out home loans, they have that insurance that's coupled with it. Is that not included in the insurance so that they can make use of that provision? And also, is that only an option for once in a lifetime? The other question that I'm having is in terms of the restructures. You mentioned that numbers of interested of people who benefited through that restructure, but I want to know the percentage that you have in total relieved, because if you have the total number of 30,000, we don't know 30,000 out of how many people you've saved. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you so much, Honourable Williams.
Thank you, Chair. My question again is around certainty. I want to know from Nedbank, what do you think, which debt relief or debt forgiveness measures would give you more certainty that we would come up with? I'd also like to know that same question for all the banks, if they could come back to us in writing, which, you know, debt relief measures would give them more certainty. If they could give us a list that would say this would give us more certainty, and then right at the bottom this would give us no certainty at all if you did this. That's the type of thing I'm looking for. Thank you.
Just to follow up there, Honourable Hill-Lewis, yes.
Yes. So currently the National Credit Regulator doesn't allow for banks to have relationships with debt counsellors because there's obviously a conflict of interest. So it's interesting that you say that you do refer customers to debt counsellors. Could you, in writing, give us a list of some examples of where you have referred customers to debt counsellors?
Let me just clarify that question right now. So I think I answered in the context that we advise clients undergo debt counselling. I don't think we refer them to a particular XYZ debt counsellor.
Right. I do just have a question myself, but I think Honourable Van Schalkwyk has got a follow-up.
No, Chair, it's actually a question that I omitted. I wanted to know in terms of the rehabilitation of the philosophy that you have in terms of consumer rehabilitation, do you have a mechanism to track if it is in fact successful or what the success rate is? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much indeed. Now, a couple of the points here. In fact, you've gone into it quite clearly and you're offering a couple of interesting initiatives here, I must say, but you also talk about the duration or something, it's suspended or whatever for a while, and I was wondering, in suspending it or whatever, holding it back, does the interest accumulate during that time? Or is, you know, the capital and the interest then held at that particular time and so on? The other thing is, do you have a credit department that, to describe what one client said, not about your bank, another bank that's sitting here, continual harassment while she was in hospital and threatened with a sheriff? You know, so I was just wondering how your bank is doing in that regard, because it got so bad that the surgeon had to phone the bank. You know, I mean, the woman was deteriorating with these constant calls and they took the telephone away from her as well. But I also want to mention here in passing that you mentioned about the maternity sort of leave, the unemployment and so on, but quite clearly you have a time period, some sort of cap. I certainly can't come to you and then be unemployed for a year, which could happen. So if you could just give us some kind of indication in that regard. But I just wanted to mention to all of you here, which I know you're well aware of, that some of these mines, that is Umplutz and Lonmin, notwithstanding their back track record in the past, they are now coming to the party, as it were, and assisting. And from what they are saying, there are numerous sort of, you know, what can I call them, emolument orders, attachment orders, etc., and also, you know, the garnishy orders and so on and so forth. It's as if they've been abandoned by their bank, and some of them have been with that particular bank, and it's just unfortunate that the Ned Bank is just sitting before me, but they are also my banks. I feel I am at liberty. That, banks just seem not to be that concerned. So that is why these large employment houses, as some of you heard from the Chamber of Mines, have now had to say, woo, now hang on, let's just put a stop to this. And it's what I used to call in Gauteng, the employed poor. You know, by the time you got your salary, it was a negative, with all these garnishy orders, etc., etc. So I don't know, and we will come to that, and I'm sure in the study group, what kind of database is there? Because as it turned out, the bank had to admit to the surgeon, they didn't even have the payment advice slip of this woman. So I don't know how she ever got the loan in the first place. Do you follow? Now, I'm not mentioning the bank. That would be very unfair of me. But it's not Nedbank. That I can assure you. But having said that, will you please respond to the question?
All right, thanks. Okay, if I start with the consolidation question. So when we say consolidation, it's not our own debts. It could be, you know, a credit card somewhere else, a personal loan somewhere else, something else somewhere else. And what we're saying is, client comes to us with a request. We say, okay, fine. Then we consolidate all those loans. We'll settle all those banks and then offer an interest. So I cannot answer your question as to whether is it capital and interest somewhere else or in ours. It's the amount that's outstanding, and we consolidate the amount outstanding. Okay. I think there were a couple of questions around freezing of payment, and I think largely around time period. So yes, there are. It's not an open-ended arrangement. We try and do it within reason. Limits like once a year, that's right. We might put some of those curtailments just to again ensure that the client remains true to the loan repayments and the obligations he or she has. So yes, there is a limitation. It's not a open-ended arrangement from that perspective. In terms of restructures, percentage of clients, I think I mentioned something like 30,000 we've kept about 30,000 people in the home, in the homes. So that would be about 10% of our home loan clients on average, because we have between 300 and 350,000 home loan clients. I don't have the exact number with me. I can certainly supply a written answer to that question. I think there was a question around certainty. What kind of certainty would we look for? I think what I'm suggesting, Honorable Member, is that first, you know, I would actually encourage the subcommittee to get behind what we're saying, understand the numbers, and then see whether there is need for legislated debt relief or debt forgiveness mechanisms. That's what I'm actually saying. So, you know, certainty is a question that I'm, you know, looking to answer after we've crossed that point. In terms of rehabilitation, how many clients have we rehabilitated? Happy to supply that answer in writing. Okay. Duration of, when I talked of legal action, suspension, and all of that, yes, the interest does accumulate. I think it's important to understand that when we grant a loan, we ourselves pay funding costs on that, on those loans. So if on our other side, the interest clock is ticking, likewise, it will continue ticking on the side of the consumer, right? So, as such, interest therefore remains accumulative, if I can answer that question. In terms of credit department, yes, we do have collections departments. We do call clients. We're very conscious of the circumstances, however. These calls are recorded, and the calls that are recorded are monitored actively by our audit teams. So I think if such abuse was taking place, we would find it very quickly. In terms of EAOs, we certainly, you know, very hopeful that the new rules around managing EAOs and how they need to be applied for will be more controlled in future with a specific set of rules that the Justice Department, I know, is working in consultation with the regulator. We are supportive of those. We certainly have not issued any new EAOs in the last 4 or 5 years. We think that it's a very, very last resort measure and certainly should not be open to abuse. Consumers must be left with money in their pockets for daily living expenses. So, you know, the past scenario where there were so many EAOs, like you point out, that, you know, the borrower had no money left, that's unsustainable. So we certainly do not subscribe to how they've been used in the past. I think I've answered all the questions.
If there's anything that, you know, you recall, do respond in writing. And, you know, you've got Mr. Hermans right next to me here, who's in constant communication with the stakeholders who come here. Please, any clarification, he's got it. All right? But certainly, Mr. Desai, we must thank you. I'm sure you've been a credit to your bank. But, of course, there are a number of other issues we will be raising ourselves in writing to all of you. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you.
Well, on that succinct note, let us ask African Bank, are you quite healthy now? Right. Followed by engagement. No, well, I mean, at one stage, you were in intensive care, weren't you? Right. Going ahead, just straight ahead then, African Bank, which is starting off at just after 10:02. You can see there it is actually 10:02. So please go ahead. And
thank
that
you.
Is Mr.
Swanepoel,
right.
Thank you, Chairperson, honorable members, fellow bankers. We are the the new African Bank, not the previous African Bank. So I think that from our side, I think that we had valuable lessons that we could learn from the previous bank. Although we have the same name, but we luckily have a different registration number. We do subscribe to the DCRS system. We believe that it is applied by us in, and it gives us very good results. The concessions that we do make is interest rates as far as zero. We waive fees and the term of the credit agreements get extended. We also offer payment moratoriums, restructuring or bespoke arrangement with clients. It is a regular feature of our business for clients that experience financial difficulties. We do make concessions on interest rates, term, and on installments. We try and provide the customers the opportunity for them to make individual arrangements for their specific circumstances. We have a product that we offer debt consolidation to consolidate our clients' debt with the aim of reducing their monthly installments. Sometimes when they have lots of agreements, there's a fee on every one of these agreements, and by consolidating, you reduce the fees for the client. We have settlement campaigns that we offer specifically to our customers that that are in default to try and allow those customers at a discounted basis for them to settle their debt that they do have, and we do offer them settlements depending on their individual circumstances. We have a product that we offer retrenchment cover for our customers, and we cover full retrenchment cover in the event that our clients should be retrenched, irrespective of the retrenchment circumstance. That means even involuntary retrenchment, our client's loan will be settled in full when they have retrenchment cover that is included in our credit life insurance. We proactively inform our customers when they get retrenched or when they go into default. We try and proactively advise them of the fact that they, when they have retrenchment cover, that they can claim against that. So one of the things that we have found is that sometimes when people get retrenched, they are not contactable, and we try and make, get hold of those customers and inform them that there is insurance cover that they can claim on. Initially, their payments are then serviced by the insurance, and eventually, if they don't find alternative employment, their loans are then settled in full. From the legal and other challenges, we believe that the debt relief process should be a voluntary, and it should not should be based on prescribed debt relief principles. And we believe that it must become part of a creditor's credit provider's registration conditions. We feel that if more credit providers do this, I think it would benefit lots of the customers. I think this is not only to the benefit of one of the credit providers, this is to the whole financial society and to the whole country if we can solve somebody's debt. The current legislation, we believe, should permit credit providers to list customers that is under statutory debt counselling or participating in voluntary debt relief on the bureaus. And the reason for that is currently not all customers are listed on the bureaus when they are under debt counselling. Therefore, they sometimes take further debt while they are under debt counselling. And we believe that the legislation should be amended that credit providers can update the bureaus so that those customers don't take any further debt, and that will assist in the rehabilitation of those customers. We also believe that the current legislation should be amended, that product insurance should become part of the cost of credit. One of the big abuses today is product insurance that is sold to customers. They would buy a fridge and they would get product insurance which is not regulated anywhere. It's not part of the cost of the credit, and eventually the customer will pay more on the product insurance than what he pays for the fridge. So we believe that that is something that the legislation could be amended, that product insurance should form part of the cost of credit.
You're also quite alarmed, Honourable Hilda.
We believe that credit providers should only be permitted to grant customers no more than 2 payday or 1 month loans in a 12-month cycle. We have seen that payday loans is abused. We have seen that customers sometimes have 12 consecutive payday loans. Now that normally gets a client into a credit crunch, and he cannot get out of it. We believe that that is something that can be looked at in the regulations. There is big abuse in payday loans, and sometimes people end up that they are forced that they must take it out every month. We propose on debt relief measures. We propose that there should be a voluntary debt mediation service to lower income consumers earning less than a predetermined threshold. this should be to no cost to the consumer and funded by credit providers. This is for customers that cannot afford debt counseling. So we have given an amount of what we believe that the threshold could be, but that is, there is no research really, and we should establish that from debt counselors, what would be the a threshold from where customers really cannot afford a debt counselor. We believe a service like that would have the same, can apply over a period of 5 years, that it can solve over 5 years, which is the same in line with the DCRS criteria. Unsecured and revolving credit products should be included in this process. It should be voluntary. People should voluntarily apply for this debt relief. Debt relief criteria would include the same as what the DCRS rules would be, and that is the extension of the term, reduction of the interest rate and the waiver of fees. This program should be held by a non-profit organization. This is not something that somebody should do for profit. We believe that it should be done not for profit. Then we have noted some, this was on question four, on impact and consequences. We believe that it's fundamental that when of lending is the repayment of the loan, and this should not in any way be compromised by implementing any debt relief measures. Any debt relief measure that is introduced should not cause further deterioration to the financial industry, and it should be aimed at strengthening our economy. The repayment of monies lent to a customer promotes financial stability and investor confidence in the financial markets. And any relief measures should take cognizance of maintaining the financial stability of the South African financial markets. Debt relief measures should be aimed at customers in a lower income segment with the aim of providing debt relief to distressed customers. These customers may be rehabilitated and are then able to re-enter the credit market. The implementation of debt relief measures should not result in the expropriation of rights of a credit provider, but the measures should be based on fair commercial principles, which will take into account the rights of both the consumer as well as the credit provider. And then ring fencing of debt relief measures to define lower income segment of the market may increase the cost of for consumers generally, but such debt relief measures should only be implemented if the larger benefit to the society and the economy as a whole would offset the cost of that. Then we have some responses to some of the questions that were posed on Tuesday. African Bank supports responsible lending and discourages consumption lending. It is not something that is very easily controlled. We do ask customers what the money is for, and in the responses that we have seen from customers, they have the option to tell us what it is for, and you will find that there's unfortunately we have a section that is other, and that is the other is being ticked in the majority of the cases, where we do see that education and housing plays a probably the two most important places that people do use money for. Based on the NCR statistic, unsecured lending reduced significantly since 2012. So there has been a dramatic reduction from what the levels were in 2012. And I think that the new affordability regulations that came in, we support that, and we believe that those regulations, if they are applied properly, prevents granting of any reckless credit, And I believe that if it is enforced on all credit providers, I believe that we will have much less over-indebted customers. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Mr. Swanepoel. What the name of your colleague?
Via Milliken.
Thank you very much to both of you. Honourable Hill Lewis. That looks like it. Right. Honourable Quernell. Right.
Yes, thank you very much, Mr. Swanepoel. Very refreshingly excellent presentation with specific suggestions that I think the subcommittee will certainly take further and consider very seriously. Two questions. You've only been in operation for a few months, but do you practice what you preach in terms of revolving payday loans? Do you only offer one or two per year? And when that limit is reached, do you convert it to a longer-term personal loan, or do you simply turn off the taps, as it were? Then, secondly, why do you think that I really like the idea that of the voluntary debt mediation process to lower-income consumers, as you will have heard if you were there, I forget if you were there on Tuesday, that is a problem with DCRS, is that it doesn't apply to low-income consumers. But I just wonder why it should be done by a non-profit organization. That sounds a bit fuzzy. Why can't it be done by ordinary debt counselors if it's done at the cost of the credit provider? I would prefer for them to have an incentive to go and actively seek those customers and help them and market to them and seek them out in the marketplace. And I think a profit incentive helps them to do that, especially if it's at your expense.
Thank you, Honourable Hill Lewis. Honourable Mkongi.
I just want to add my thanks to the presentation.
A good idea. Honourable Mkongi.
No, I just wanted to know. You said you are a new African bank. Yeah. Is it? What happened to the debt of the old African bank?
I actually don't want to entertain that right now because we did deal with this last year in depth, and we will, when we have more time, deal with it again. But it did puzzle us because, as you said now, you are delinked. You want to forget about your previous relationship. And I think, which I thought unwise, but be that as it may, I want to actually congratulate you so far for being the only one that responded to each question systematically. But perhaps you've had a lot of experience of that now. Fine. Over to you.
Thank you, Chairperson. To the Honourable Hill, we do practice what I preach, and we do not offer payday loans at all, or one-month loans. We believe that it is not to the benefit of a customer. But I do give benefit. Sometimes the clients do need a short bridging loan. So we do not say that it should not be done. But this rolling of payday loans is what we have a problem with. And we can give you the statistics. When a customer starts rolling a payday loan, he will default on all his debt. That there is no doubt about that. The reason why we believe that we said that it should be a non-profit organization is debt counselors are in there to make money. And if a credit provider is going to fund such a voluntary scheme, we believe that it should not make money out of the banks for doing that. The banks already take an enormous loss when a client goes into voluntary debt mediation. So as we said, in some cases the banks take the interest rates to zero as well as the fees just to assist the clients. So if we end up paying debt counselors to make a profit still, I don't believe that would be the incentive. I have no problem that debt counselors do it. It would be very great if debt counselors do it, but not at the same fees as what they are charging, because currently they do make serious profits on it. And then, Chairperson, I can respond, you know, it's, in a limited way is what happened to the debt. And I think you referred to the previous book, what is now called Residual Debt Services. We do manage that book, and we do collect that book on behalf of the creator. We apply exactly the same rules as what we, that I've said that we apply for African Bank. We apply those same rules are applied for residual debt services for those customers that we still collect on the behalf of that company. So we would, those customers we still look after. The, you know, interesting thing is that some customers are both in the old residual debt services as well as in African Bank, and we treat the customers on exactly the same basis and don't discriminate against them.
I'd like you, if you've got anything to add to that, because you've given us a very succinct response to our questions. Do you want to submit another question, Honourable Hill-Loop?
I just wanted to say I didn't realise the creator was in the business of collecting money.
I must say, very interesting spin that was, but be that as it may, thank you, APSA. And can we then move to First Rand Bank? Right, and in the interim, while you're all getting ready, I want to congratulate the DG. You know, he's the best performing Director General at National, and this is several times he's won these awards. It's about a penny. He won this silver one. I mean, a champion there. Strategic direction, leadership, creativity. Don't know how many other things. But he truly is a remarkable DG and extremely professional, I must say. Thank you. So there it is. I just don't know if his chest won't be too heavy with all these medals in the last 5 years, you know. So you may want to just make a little suggestion to him, the weight. Right. Thank you very much. Right. Over to, I think it is First National Bank. Is that right? First Rand Bank. Wow, right. Ms. Krauss, is that right? And your colleague?
I'm Yvette Singh, and I'm from First Rand Chair.
Sorry,
Yvette Singh. And we've got three brands. That's why it's a bit confusing. So, Hanelie Krauss is responsible for, she's head of credit for F&B, but we also have WesBank in our stable, so our colleagues are sitting on that side.
We all know. Fine. Right. Go ahead then, please. Who's starting?
So, I'll start, Chair.
And I don't have your name, you see. Ms. Singh, I have it now, but, you know, we put it down. Right. Let's, you know, I think we should follow, at the very least, the APSA, notwithstanding their history, have certainly learnt a few lessons. A very succinct presentation. Let's have the same.
Thank you, Chair. We would just like to start off by just giving an overview of the credit industry, and then we would like to share with you the existing measures of to combat over-indebtedness from an industry perspective, and what we do at First Rand in terms of F&B and WesBank in terms of our voluntary program. Then we have some further potential solutions we would like to share with you, and then also the impact consequences and challenges of legislating debt relief measures. And then we would just like to thank the portfolio community for the opportunity that we have to engage with you. We do believe that whatever solution needs to be appropriately sustainable so that we can assist customers without having a negative impact on the economy or the banking sector, and we would like to engage with you further as we continue on these discussions. So I'll just hand over to Ms. Krauss that will just give you the overview of the credit industry and some further detail.
Industry? I think we've already had that, but just very briefly.
I think we felt it important just to highlight that
I think the consequence of over-indebtedness has many facets, and it stems from, yes, some sharp growth in credit that was granted post the financial crisis, but also other aspects that have happened. And I think the debt relief components that we're discussing particularly today and earlier in the week relates to both. There are reasons, multiple reasons, why customers find themselves in an over-indebted position. And it's important to then deal not just with the consequences but also the reasons. And I think at the outset we, as a bank and as an industry, were very supportive of the legislative changes which were introduced last year. And I think if one, and the reason we've put this slide in is merely to demonstrate that you could already clearly see a correlation between the stricter affordability criteria which was introduced from September and how that has impacted positively the level of impairments or customers with impaired records. So we do believe that those were very focused and positive interventions that in future should place the credit industry as a whole in a much better stead and position. I think a lot of my counterparts at the other banks have spoken about debt review. There are not widely published statistics available around the portfolio size of loans under debt review. At a banking industry level, we do share just amongst banking industry the extent of those portfolios, and other banks have commented about that. But I think it is important that as a committee we understand that currently there's approximately 46 billion rands worth of debt under debt review, and that's only in the banking industry. If one were to add the retail sector, I'm sure that figure would be closer to 50 billion, which is a substantial portion of debt which is currently being managed in a fashion to provide debt relief. And again, I think a lot of my counterparts have spoken about the fact that the DCRS system is something that we ascribe to and provides for concessions far greater than what I think the NCA envisaged. So the NCA does not make provision for interest to be zeroized, fees to be written off, but those were voluntary concessions which the industry has agreed to. And I think we are all saying, let's try and encapsulate that in a broader sense in the debt relief mechanism to give the support. So we are fully supportive of the changes that were introduced, but we do believe that there are still some abusive mechanisms that need to be tackled via legislative changes. And Chair, you have mentioned earlier just emolument attachment orders. There are practices that have led to credit providers or sub-credit providers taking higher risk than what they would ordinarily do if they didn't have those collection practices. And we do believe that there are mechanisms, and some of them are already underway, to make those changes to legislation. This is just a summary, and I'm not going to dwell on it. I think a lot of it has been discussed. The aspect that perhaps I do want to highlight, and my colleague or counterpart from African Bank has alluded to it, but credit life insurance is a very important component that is typically included as part of the product which is sold an unsecured loan to a customer, and it covers not only just the life component, but it does have a retrenchment in many cases. And that we've seen in the last number of months with the downturn in the economy and certain industry quite hard hit, the benefit that cover can bring to consumers. So at First Rand and FNB in particular, we have a product which covers the customer for 6 months worth of installments in the case of an retrenchment. If they've not found another job opportunity within that 6 month period, the debt is expunged. So the insurance actually then settles the debt. The piece that we are proposing that needs to be finalized is the credit life cover that we provide as part of our unsecured product covers the customer for retrenchment. So we would provide them with 6 months worth of cover. So the insurance actually covers the 6 month installment. If after 6 months they have not been able to secure another job, the debt is then settled by the insurance. Now that, I think, in the environment that we found ourselves is a very important component which sometimes is not known, where customers actually do benefit from that insurance. The component that we have proposed, and we've had lots of engagement with the credit regulator and the DTI on it, is the fact that the credit life premium is not regulated or capped per se. The NCA speaks about
that the cost needs to be reasonable, but it doesn't prescribe a cap. And there has been draft regulation published on that, but that it has not been finalized. So we would propose that gets promulgated as soon as possible, because it does then provide credit providers and insurers with legal certainty around what cover could be extended at what cost and how we could optimize that cover. So that's one of the other mechanisms and that we believe could assist customers. And if that cap is reasonable, and we do believe that was outlined in the regulations or the draft regulations, that it is in fact a reasonable cap and could provide substantial cover at a relatively low cost. I will talk later on in the presentation just about some of the other Magistrate Court Act changes that we believe are relevant. But I think, again, just to give the committee some comfort, and again, we have, as a group have worked quite closely with the credit regulator on improving quality of data at the Credit Bureau. We have a project which has been in the making for the best part of 5 years called Project Evolution that now allows for new credit agreements as well as cancelled or settled credit agreements to be updated at the Bureau within a 72-hour period so that we make credit decisions on much more informed and recent data. In addition to that, the information which currently is not on the Bureau, we are trying very hard to get those also enhanced, the Bureau data layout, in order to provide that data. And garnishee orders or emolument attachment orders was one of the proposals made, so that we can, if we could have that data available on the Bureau, it would greatly assist in the affordability calculations and highlight the extent to which customers have these emolument attachment orders loaded. At the moment, that data is not available anywhere. It basically just sits in the payroll systems of the companies that have to administer these. So turning to the voluntary measures that we apply within the First Rand Group is, I think, in the first instance, and we've briefly touched on that, the credit life insurance that we have available on our unsecured loans product. And we use the engagement with the customer, particularly at the outset where they contact us to say they've lost their jobs, to try and see that we can initiate that credit life insurance claim as soon as possible. We also make bespoke payment arrangements with customers, much like what my counterparts at the other banks have spoken about. We do have settlement campaigns where we would provide customers with an opportunity to settle their outstanding debt at a discount. And this would also apply in the case of mortgages where there could have been a shortfall. I think we all look at individual circumstances, look at the customer's circumstances surrounding their cash flow and their ability to service the debt, and would make arrangements that are suitable and sort of provide for a win-win situation for the bank as well as for the consumer. Payment holidays, I think, is something that, again, is quite prevalent. We do have customers that contact us quite proactively to say, I'm going on maternity leave or I will not have an income for 3 months. How can you assist? We have been a firm believer that emolument attachment orders should preferably not be used at all for the collection of debt. We do believe it plays a role in collection of other obligations such as maintenance, etc. But as a debt collection mechanism, particularly in early stage collections, we believe that that is an abusive practice that should be stopped. And there are now Magistrate Court amendments which are underway. And I think you're all aware of the case in the Stellenbosch case that was brought to the High Court that I think will force some legislative changes around this abusive practice. I think my counterparts at the other banks have not spoken about the fact that we do as an industry need to provide appropriate low-cost banking solutions to customers, and I think we as a group try to, on an ongoing basis, improve and offer lower-cost banking to customers, because that also assists the affordability. We do look at customers' individual products that they have with us and enter into repayment plans. And if they demonstrate to us a willingness to pay and they settle this or repay a certain proportion, we would always consider looking at a refund of interest if payment arrangements are kept. And then more recently, and particularly following the downturn in the economy with certain industries very hard hit, the steel industry, the mining industry, but also other industries, we internally have established a support fund that we manage centrally out of my office, where we aim to assist vulnerable customers who demonstrate a willingness to pay, but were particularly affected within those industries. And we have all of our collection areas for our different products that would submit to a central point deserving cases, and we focus specifically on low-income customers with a view of trying to insist or ensure that they retain their home. So we focus specifically on the low-income housing component in order to try and assist customers. And that's not a payment holiday. We actually provide them with support in terms of an interest subsidy for a defined period. Interest subsidy for a defined period. We have tried to answer some of the questions that arose from the session on Tuesday. Unfortunately, I was not able to attend. I'm not going to go through these in detail, but again, happy to take questions. I think a lot of what we have covered here, the other banks have also covered, and I think it's just to try and give the committee some comfort that at a very practical level, we really try and in all cases ensure that a silent execution is a last resort. We do not want to go to silent execution at an early collection mechanism. It typically takes us at least 2 years, if not longer, before it would ever get there. And I think there are well-defined processes. We're not saying it could not be improved, and we have spoken about some of the reserve pricing issues, etc. But I think if one looks at the context in terms of the number of sales and executions done in relation to the assisted sales that we do, where customers voluntarily come forward and want us to assist with them selling the property, and in relation to the number of new mortgages registered, it is but a drop in the ocean if one were to look at what is sold in execution. And it should always be a last resort. On the vehicle finance side, I think a similar process or approach is followed, where we would rather assist the customer to voluntarily sell the vehicle in order to alleviate stress. And it's done in a partnership with the bank instead of incurring expensive recovery costs. And the credit bureau record then does not reflect the repossession of the vehicle, as would be the case where the customer actually defaults. If the vehicle is ever sold through, or if the vehicle is sold through this process and there is a shortfall, again, a discount will be applied to the shortfall balance, and that balance could be repaid at a lower interest rate. So I think as a bank and as a group, we're certainly amenable to looking at how we actually discount some of those interest rates. Not in a like-for-like basis to debt review or DCRS, but to actually assist customers where there is a willingness to pay. And I think that's the cornerstone of a lot of our voluntary mechanisms. It's just the willingness from a customer or demonstration of a willingness to pay, albeit that they may not have the financial means to do that, and then to engage with them in terms of making a suitable arrangement. I think it's also important that we look at, and as a credit person, we deal and we see a lot of individual cases coming across our desks, and I've referred earlier to the fact that customers find themselves in financial difficulty, yes, one of which could be over-indebtedness, and we've seen the fact that credit extension grew quite sharply. It has tapered off substantially since the financial crisis and some legislative changes. But I think we also need to be mindful of the fact that when one looks at some of these customers that are overburdened, there is an extent of over-insurance, funeral policies, life policies, etc., that sometimes is also deducted from their pay on a monthly basis. And I know that there are discussions with National Treasury looking at what, who should and what industry should have access to payroll deductions. It again provides an easy collection mechanism, but could be abused or could create opportunities for customers to find themselves in financial difficulty because they actually have over-insurance, etc. A lot has been said in the media, and I think we're all aware of the fact that there are unauthorized debits which customers find in their banking accounts, 99 rand debits, etc. And we feel quite strongly that there has to be a mechanism for customers to protect their banking and their income. So we do, as all the banks do, allow that, and the payment rules allow for disputes of valid debit or invalid debit orders that are loaded, where the money is actually returned to the customer. And that's another mechanism of actually assisting customers. However, one finds when you introduce such measures that there is some component or some proportion of customers that abuse these facilities as well. And it sometimes surprises us to see to what extent that happens. So, for instance, we've made available a mechanism to dispute a debit order, but we did find quite a large number of customers were disputing valid debit orders, which I think, again, just highlights or demonstrates the fact that if one looks at relief measures or assistance programs, that there has to be a balance between the customer's rights as well as the credit or the service provider's rights. And we firmly believe that we will continue to engage with customers on an individual basis to ensure that debt relief measures are tailored to their individual circumstances. And we're also committed to providing suitable banking solutions at lower cost to consumers. Our e-wallet product, for those of you that may know, is a widely used mechanism for customers in the low-income categories, which facilitates the transfer of money at virtually no cost to the customer. The sender pays a small fee. But over 5 million customers have benefited from solutions like that. And yes, it is a cornerstone of the FNB philosophy that we try and be innovative, particularly within the electronic and digital space, to provide lower cost, suitable banking solutions to our customers. Just in terms of the proposed solutions, I'm going to go through them quite quickly. A lot has actually been covered in prior presentations, but the use or the increased use of ECRS where customers qualify, so I think that would greatly assist. It also is a process that ensures consistency of concessions between different credit providers. The draft regulations on credit life insurance in terms of the cap I've mentioned. We do believe that there is opportunity and various amendments have been proposed to the insolvency bill to assist, it's called NINA customers, no income, no asset customers. It is at the moment a process that isn't used in the low income space, but we do believe and various proposals were made through the Banking Association that with some amendments there could be a lower cost or no cost solution to customers that find themselves in that position and therefore do not qualify. Because they have no income, they do not qualify for a debt review solution. Yeah. Then the emolument attachment orders, I think we've covered. And then also just administration orders, we believe there is opportunity to look at that process. The various amendments have been proposed, but these have not actually been implemented yet. And collectively between a voluntary mechanism, which I think, again, some of my counterparts have alluded to, that we could implement something particularly for low-income customers. We've just calculated quite recently that on relatively smaller debt, so debt, let's say, in total of below 50,000 Rand, the debt review process is quite costly in relation to the size of the debt. So the cost of that customer with say, 50,000 Rand outstanding debt collectively could range between probably 7,000 or 8,000 Rand over the term of that rearrangement order. And fortunately, that's quite high. So I think my counterpart at African Bank mentioned the fact that a voluntary mechanism particularly aimed at the lower income customers with smaller debt exposures could actually be quite a suitable solution. I think it just, for us, we felt it just important to highlight that we would not, and I think sometimes the terms are used interchangeably, debt relief or debt forgiveness, that we would not support that, but I think you've alluded to that, Chair. I think we also feel that there should be policy certainty and stability within the financial sector, and that we don't really believe that there's at this stage need for further legislative debt relief measures specifically other than those that we've already highlighted. I think there is evidence that quite a lot is being done already within the banking sector to actually assist customers as best we can. And I think the African Bank example was quoted. We've alluded to the fact here that there is systemic risk in the industry, and we have to ensure that there is within our economy, I think the large financial organizations, but just the financial services sector more broadly, needs to be quite secure, and that then ensures that there is no cost additional burden placed on the government, the taxpayer, or individual consumers out there. So, I mean, we would be firmly of the view that policy certainty, a sustainable financial sector and market is positive for the economy and would create a lot of certainty in terms of investment going forward. I think in conclusion, and I have kind of rushed through it quite quickly, but we do want to, again, I think just affirm Yvette's comments earlier that we really appreciate the opportunity to engage, and we would look forward to further engagement at an industry and an individual level on particular measures that you believe should be further investigated. I think there's always useful engagements that happen, and I think the recent engagements on some of the legislative changes that we've had in terms of the NCA have proven that through a collective engagement that we actually do get to find a good outcome and a sustainable outcome. I have tried to answer quite a number of the questions posed in the previous session in the presentation, but one in particular, which was the risk premium on mortgages, there was a question earlier. I'm not going to cover it. I think to a large extent it echoes what my counterpart at Nedbank has outlined. Thank you, Chair. With that, I'll conclude.
Thank you very much, Ms. Kraft, and also Ms. Singer. Thank you both. To both of you. Now, we are just taking a look on my list to see if there are any comments, questions. Honourable Hill Lewis.
Honourable
Conkey.
Two questions. Three questions. It's good to hear from all of the banks that emolument attachment orders don't seem to be used anymore. I think emolument attachment orders have become rather unfashionable since there's been so much public attention placed on them. But it's good that at least now banks have stopped using them. Did you use them in the past, and how many emolument attachment orders do you still have in place to collect? Okay. Then the second question is, you, as I understand it, Westbank is the biggest vehicle lender in the country. That's my understanding. Now, you know, unaffordable luxury vehicles are one of the greatest destroyers of personal wealth in South Africa, and one of the quickest ways to get yourself into an unsustainable debt trap, especially because vehicle finance companies offer these very, very attractive finance terms, like 30 and 40 and even more percent balloon payments and the like. Now, when one approaches a bank for a home loan, the general rule is that the monthly repayments cannot exceed 30% of your before-tax income. I believe it is. Yes, it's your gross income, not your net income. Now, what is the rule that you apply at Westbank in terms of what percentage you will allow a customer's car repayments to consume of their total monthly income? And do you make use of these dangerous kind of financial acrobatics in terms of trying to make a customer's monthly payment fit in those caps? Thank you.
Very much, Honourable Hill Lewis. Honourable
Thank you very much. I just want to understand what kind of assistance are you saying you are giving to clients who has unauthorized deductions? For an example, you find that when people are going to your bank and then they ask that you write off those illegal debit orders, and then they are told that they must go to those companies, and they don't know where to get those companies and everything, and no one is prepared to help them. So what kind of services are you providing those people to make sure that they do not go into unnecessary payment of debt? The second one, to give loans to people to buy RDP houses. I saw something when a property agent is selling houses, RDP houses, then he's begging somewhere, that person. So do you give loans for such?
No, thank you very much. There was something here which I was very impressed with a few things, but I was looking here on, well, I haven't got the slide, but it's the additional measures applicable to vehicle finance. You referred to, instead of incurring expensive recovery costs, etc., does not reflect a repossession. So you take measures, you offer measures and assistance to avoid a person being listed, as it were. I wasn't even aware they were still being listed. But exactly what do you mean when you talk about a client should demonstrate a willingness to pay? What would you regard as a willingness to pay? Just someone being rather pleasant on the phone, or what? You know, that kind of thing. I think it's been quite fair here, but now the payment holidays, I must say I've never been offered anything like that. Now, it's an interest-free, you know, what is it? There is an interest subsidy for a defined period, and this applies to this holiday that they're going to enjoy, no doubt over Christmas. But can you just explain how that works without encouraging them to get into more debt? Because I think what we're looking at would be better, but I don't want to say no because you're making every effort. Go ahead.
Just to answer the question on emolument attachment orders, I can with confidence say that we have none in place. It used to be a practice that I guess all of the banks or credit providers used. We have not used it probably for the last 5 or 6 years, and those that we had in place, we have cancelled. We have written off that debt. Turning to your second question around balloon payments, the affordability criteria that I think we had in place at an industry level, where we set sort of installment to income ratios both on mortgages and vehicles, probably predates the NCA. And with the NCA affordability criteria, we now have an inclusive affordability that looks at all debt commitments, and obviously it needs to meet the requirements of the NCA. But over and above that, then each of our franchises, in particular Westbank, would have their own criteria to look at what they believe is a sustainable level of installment to income for a vehicle finance. So for somebody that, and we as a group have an overall debt exposure limit that we use as a risk mitigant or an absolute cap, it's not prescribed or linked to the NCA requirements at all, but that we feel is a prudent level beyond which customers should not encumber their income. So we apply a ratio that we look at, and it not only includes the debt that we have lent them as first rand, but all commitments which are reflected on the bureau. So I think it is possible that you may have circumstances where an individual may qualify and would use more than 30% of their income towards a car installment, but I think those are isolated cases. I think the risk profile of customers that Westbank deal with is of a nature that we would, one, obviously look at just their ability to service the debt, and that has to be paramount in the risk decision. So, you know, to encumber somebody's income to 50-60%, typically that doesn't happen. The fact of balloons, I think, is a reality in the market. Westbank do use balloon or do structure deals, again, for lower risk customers with balloon payments. And I think it's probably fair, and a lot of us probably been in the circumstance where you use your car for a defined period with the intention of then buying a new car. And I think the balloon payment enables affordable installment over a defined period. Many customers then sell their vehicle and the full outstanding debt is settled. For those who wish to retain their car, they actually would then finance the balloon portion as well. We specifically look at a risk profile, and we would, similar to, you know, much mention has been made about debt consolidation, etc., would offer those only to customers that we feel comfortable with the risk profile and their affordability profile. So it's not done, definitely not done, in a manner that then tries to encumber them to an extent which they later on would find themselves in difficulty. The assistance that we provide applied to customers with unauthorized debits, and I think there's quite a lot of sort of rules associated with debit orders which are not known to customers out there. We have specifically introduced mechanisms through our in-contact messaging to customers to alert them to new debit orders are loaded against their bank account. And if they believe that those are unauthorized, there's a mechanism. So we try and be quite proactive in terms of communicating to customers what debit orders are loaded, particularly new debit orders. And then we have made...
No, that's what we're trying to address. We are trying to address it. I asked the technical man not to move. Now, he clearly has done exactly that. So, yes, that's very good of you, Dean. Maybe another colleague, because you're on the floor next. Honourable McPherson, you should sit down and someone else should proceed. No. Now, sit down. You're next. Proceed, Ms. Krauss.
So we try through our in-contact messaging to make customers aware of debit orders loaded to their account. And we also then have on our online banking facilities mechanisms available for them to then dispute an unauthorized debit order, also through our call centers and our branch network. So many customers, I think that the only mechanism for them is to actually approach the service provider. But in many cases, they can't get hold of them. So it is important that we as a bank provide an opportunity for them to say this debit was unauthorized, and the payment association rules through PSD that was agreed actually make provision for that. So it's a question of, again, customer education to make sure that they understand what their rights are and to protect what is happening. There is, and I won't dwell on it, but there is a large industry project underway called Authenticated Collections, which aims to address some of this abuse that is happening, where customers will actually pre-authorize a new debit order before it's loaded against their bank account. Do we give loans to RDP houses? We don't have that as a product. I can't sit here and say that we have never financed perhaps a resale. We may not be aware of that if a customer made use of an unsecured loan, etc., but it's not a product that we offer because we can't register a mortgage over an RDP house or anything. Then just, Honourable Chairperson, just the assistance that we give and what we do in terms of how do we assess willingness to pay. I think it's not a tricky one, but I think you very soon realise which customers proactively contact us prior to them falling behind on their instalments, play open cards with you in order to make a payment arrangement versus those that do not want to engage with you, don't take your calls when the connection agent's phone, etc. So I think it is possible, and you do find, and most of our customers and earlier comments were made about the fact that probably 96% of our customers who borrowed from us make regular payments. I mean, our non-performing ratio is below 5% if you look at our overall portfolio. So most customers are willing and able, and then for those that are not able to, it's just demonstrate some willingness to pay and to make an arrangement, a suitable arrangement. You've referred to the payment holiday in relation to what I mentioned as the support fund. Those are two totally different mechanisms. The payment holiday is done in circumstances where the customer would say, for a three-month period, I do not have an income. Interest continues to be charged on those accounts. The special fund that we've established as a mechanism to support customers in industries hardest hit by the economic downturn is quite separate from that. We do not proactively offer it. It is something that our collections folk in our different product areas would assess and put deserving cases to us, particularly vulnerable households where there's one parent perhaps that has been retrenched. So a real bona fide application to actually provide assistance, but it's on a pure voluntary basis and not promoted in any particular way as a holiday.
Right. I'm just going to check. I don't know, Honourable McPherson, if you were just simply alerting us to mics, or did you have a question? Yes, it's not going to be responded to now. It'll be responded to in writing. Please give it to us.
Yes,
Honourable Max Thurston, your mic. What's yours like, Honourable Hill Lewis? No. You see, no, we can't continue. Know that. So, just wait. Be patient. Not easy to be patient, I know. But you must be heard, Honourable MacPherson. You must be heard. Try it again.
Lucky I've got a shop steward's voice as well. I just want to understand the difference between a balloon payment or a balloon structure deal on a vehicle and what some manufacturers refer to as a guaranteed future value. Because do you pay interest on the balloon payments? And then if you choose to refinance it, you're refinancing an interest amount from the beginning. And also, if you defaulted on a balloon payment and you auctioned the vehicle off, it would be less than the settlement value, and someone would still be the owner would still be responsible to make up the difference. But as I understand, with a guaranteed future value vehicle, it has a minimum price that it would be worth at whatever time. So surely it couldn't be sold for less than that future value, because that is what the bank or the finance institution or the company, whatever, let's say BMW, has committed to. So do you think that banks should not be offering a guaranteed future value and explain the differences? Because in my opinion, that form of financing a vehicle is far less risky than a balloon payment. And is it right, and is it explained to customers that in fact it's not your parking 30 or 40 or 50 or 60% of the value of the vehicle off to one side, but in fact you're paying interest on that balloon as well?
Thank you, Honourable MacPherson. Honourable Hill Lewis.
Thank you very much, ma'am, for your answer. I would differ and say that balloon payments allow vehicle finance institutions to enable customers to afford monthly repayments that fit into the caps laid out by the NCR and buy cars that they can't afford and which imperil their financial well-being at a later date because they are living well beyond their means. My question to you, which you are welcome to respond to in writing, is what the highest balloon payments percentages are that Westbank offer, and what the average balloon payment percentages are that Westbank offer. Secondly, Westbank engages in a very great deal of direct marketing for personal loans, not just vehicle finance. What percentage of Westbank's book is now personal loans and other forms of unsecured credit as opposed to vehicle financing? Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Hill Lewis. We've run out of time and we still have Capitec to engage. So I would appreciate it, Ms. Krauss and Ms. Singh, if you would communicate in writing to us, and this will be read out at our next meeting. All right? The second thing is there is a list that has been signed, a register, and it's been mislaid here. Who has got this register that you signed? Where is it? It's lying over here. Has everyone signed it? No. Won't you mind just taking it across? Right. Capitec. Who's Capitec here? That's Miss Mashia. Well, it says Miss. It's Mr. Yes, unfortunately they... I don't think they could see you. That's why the gender is wrong. And who else is there? Mr.
Jaco Carstens, Nkosana Mashiach.
Right. Okay. We apologize to you, and we're just worried about the system. So if you will immediately proceed.
Welcome. Thank you for the opportunity. We're grateful that we can share the Capitec perspective with you. The agenda is familiar to you, as structured per your questions and the earlier presentation by Baza. Capitec simply confirmed that we acknowledge that clients do, under certain circumstances, pick up credit and cash stress after taking up the credit. These changes may lead to distress and create a need for debt relief, and we're certainly here to support and find a solution with all parties involved. Capitec Bank offers various debt relief measures. We'll go through them each one by one. And the type of relief we want to stress at the beginning is hinging on the engagement with the client. If we focus on this sheet, we can cover most of our presentation, almost 65% to 75% of the discussion. I will provide certain perspectives to this because you haven't received any figures on it. So I will firstly start by saying Capitec offers unsecured lending. We've got 8 million banking clients. In other words, they have a savings account or they're active in their transactions with us. 4 million of those clients deposit their salary with us, and then 1.2 million of the the 8 million borrow money from us. They at the moment have a loan with us. It's unsecured lending only, so we're not going to include our discussion asset-backed or any security finance. We will now go through each and every option or that we do at the moment execute. I won't concentrate on the left-hand side because you've heard enough of that today, and that is what the NCIA at the moment provides for. On the right-hand side is what Capitec focus on. Debt counselling, about 3,000 to 4,000 of our clients apply for debt counselling every month. More than half of them are not in arrears when they apply. So that's the first perspective. I'm going to talk to you in a currency of clients. I will, for this discussion, stay to clients. If you want numbers in rands, we can also share that. So 3,000 clients to 4,000 clients applying for debt relief, but not necessarily in arrears at that moment with Capitec. Then rescheduling, there's clients that approach us for rescheduling from non-arrears, or rather we've rescheduled them from non-arrears, and others they've been up to date. That's 10,000 clients. And I'm giving you a rule of thumb because that hovers different at different levels every month, so I'm trying to give you a perspective, 10,000 clients. Another 10,000 clients are rescheduled by ways of a payment break or other examples I'll talk through later. When they are in arrears, 10,000 from non-arrears, 10,000 from arrears. Retrenchment cover, about 70 million was paid out last month, of which 40 million was for clients that claimed for retrenchment, and the other 30 million was for deceased. The 40 million were paid off, settling the full balance. We will talk through that as well. The number of clients there would be around 15,000 clients involved, of which the 10,000 clients would be the retrenchment claims. Then the other quantum perspective on the next level, debt consolidation. We do not offer debt consolidation when the client's in arrears, but some of our clients under debt stress do receive debt consolidation from other credit providers, so we'll talk through that, but then there's no number involved. Bespoke arrangements. Also, 20,000 clients that actually engage with us firstly as a default. That is what we do firstly before we do rescheduling or any other interaction. 20,000 clients. And then settlement campaigns, not very big yet at Capitec. We're trying. We're also running champion challenges in that and seeing how we can do it best. So I'm talking to you about a debt relief measures of about 50,000 clients a month, after 1.2 million clients that's on our books. We have heard of the DCRS, the Debt Counseling Rule System. We support that, and we will also conclude on that when I go through my proposals. Rescheduling, for a client that's not able to settle their arrears through a catch-up arrangement, can reschedule a loan. So a catch-up arrangement is one of those 20,000 where we arrange with the client a new debit order, and then they can catch up areas. It sounds like it's not a debt relief if you just listen to the fact that we're talking to the client is agreeing to a new debit order, but you must realize not all clients keep to that promise. Only 50% of the clients that promise based on a new debit order to pay us, that catch up, actually pay us the next month. And the result of all of that, and this is a public figure, you can look at in our financial statements, Capitec in the end of all clients that doesn't rehabilitate, in other words, the debt relief measures weren't successful, is 4 billion rand a year net of recoveries, net of future recoveries and the present value of future recoveries. In other words, the cost to Capitec for providing debt relief measures from an accountant's perspective is 4 billion rand a year in our financial statements. Clients are offered reshelling to overcome a temporary loss of income resulting from maternity leave and all the other reasons you've heard of before. Reshelling is also offered to provide cash flow relief, and we don't offer payment holidays as a product, but clients do receive a payment break when it's justifiable from the client's reason for arrears and the client is still showing the willingness to pay, and then the rehabilitation opportunity to the ability to pay later on. Reshelling is also offered to provide cash flow relief in other areas like mining. We will talk about that later when there's a strike. And then that lastly, Capitec also offers reshelling to clients who proactively want to prevent falling behind in the installments. So client often, like I mentioned earlier, there's been 10,000 clients last month that offered us before they went into arrears that knows that there's something like a medical expense that's going to cause them going into arrears. And for that, we've got the call center, but 10% of those engagements are done by the branches, and our branches are countrywide, and our branches take care of that engagement. Where the client prefers to phone us, that is where we proactively also reschedule that client. There's a bit more about rescheduling. We understood that there's a few questions about that and we wanted to provide context. It's important to remember that rescheduling is governed under the Reserve Bank Directive for Restructuring, and therefore reporting on rescheduling is governed by the Reserve Bank. Then furthermore, rescheduling is also governed by SACRA, previously called Credit Provider Association. In other words, rescheduling is reported as such as restructured on the Bureau for every other credit provider to see. Credit insurance, a full settlement of balance when there's a retrenchment.
Give a minute, just on an exigency. It seems that the DDG, Mr. Nyetsi Tensi, is that right? And is it Mr. Masharpa? No, that Mr. Masharpa is at the back. So who exactly needs to leave? Could you give me their names? Yeah. Yeah, my apologies to you then. Please continue.
Unsecured nature of Capitec loan products enable full settlement of the outstanding balance, also on the deceased side. In others, in our case, the children could not be at threat of losing the inherited property and also cannot be expected to pay the loans. Debt consolidation is also important to position. As I said, there's two sides of it. Firstly, we offer to a client the opportunity to apply for a new loan, and when they do have existing loans, we could consolidate that because that puts the client in a better position regarding the client's installments or the client's external debt is consolidated. What's more at stake here and discussed here is debt relief. In our case, when a client's in arrears, we don't offer consolidation of debt, internal or external debt. When clients do obtain other credit for that exposure, we provide a settlement certificate, and that's settled, and we certainly welcome that, and that's a justifiable practice. If there's an appetite for risk to offer consolidations, especially when there's equity involved, there's willingness, ability, and security involved, then clients do manage to settle our debt through consolidations when they're in arrears, but we don't offer that. Bespoke arrangement I have spoken about, that's the largest volume that I've mentioned earlier, where we do go into arrangement, the client agrees to a new debit order, and also sometimes are allowed to pay only partial payments until they are able to pay the full contractual installment and catch up with arrears or rescheduled all depending on the client's reason for arrears. The scoring that we apply, scoring means statistical techniques and strategies that we've put in place to understand which clients are too good to reschedule and which clients are too bad to reschedule and which ones we do allow. This is all automated through a telemanage system bought from one of the large bureaus, Experian, and it's utilizing a telephony call center based on Avaya, which is run by management, and 200 staff members then are ready to engage with our clients as they phone in or we get hold of our clients. Settlement campaigns I've mentioned earlier, at the moment not more than 1,000 clients benefited by that every month. We are still learning. We are cautious of clients abusing the opportunity to not pay on purpose. The criteria would be familiar to you. A unique circumstance is what's important to us. We wouldn't want to predetermine a debt relief measure. A debt relief measure should be established at the stage of the client's need, the reason for arrears, the circumstances, and the specific statistics involved, because we do utilize all the data available per every client when we make that decision. We do make mention also through Basel that there's an expected loss calculation involved when products are priced, also within the Basel formulas, and if there's going to be a debt relief structure that creates a lower recovery given default, then there will be an influence on the access to credit, a negative influence provided, and there will also be a negative influence on the pricing offered to especially the good clients, because for a while one will have to marginalize good clients, but after a while, after doing more analysis, understanding the debt relief structure, if it's anything different from what we know, also less access to credit. I'd just like to highlight one bullet point there so that we can finish off. Second point, credit providers, the pricing. One utilizes for typically a rate stack-up model that it takes into account the cost of credit, the initiation cost, the monthly cost, the credit and the insurance cost, and obviously when there's a lower recovery of given default in that process or a lower expected cash flow than the expected cash flow, there will be an influence in what is offered to clients. Either marginalization of the good clients, so those of us sitting in this room will be getting a worse price, and some clients won't get access to credit at all if we do not take care in how we go about in offering debt relief measures. So we propose to continue the way we are, but specifically emphasizing that DCRS should be formalized, it should be transferred to the NCR, and the amendment of conditions of registration by the NCR to enforce and increase utilization of DCR is supported by Capitec. Voluntary debt mediation system, simply revive the proof of concept, start from where we finished, but finish it in a way that everybody is happy with the terms of business regarding VDMS. Remember, a bank cannot put somebody under debt review, so we can only help the client with his or her rescheduling as far as the client have got loans with us. The client's other loan exposure we cannot help with. If the client doesn't choose to go under debt review, we cannot help that client. We need a VDMS or something like that, and we would want to open up that discussion as formal as possible. Lastly, the policy in financial inclusion by government is something that should be taken into cognizance with regards to how we approach this forward. And Kosana, I would like you to explain that, and then we're ready for questions.
Thanks.
Your colleague may want to just come in.
Yeah. This is just the last point that... my name. I think this point has been thoroughly conversed previously. Just means that in any proposal we make, we don't have any crowding out effect, and that we don't result in adverse selection problems. On otherwise explicitly mentioned policy program as spelled out both in the DTI as well as in the NDP as well as in the National Treasury financial sector programs. The pricing effect that Yako and others have spoken about, we believe that will have major consequences for the crowding out of the clients that we otherwise are aiming to focus on. Thank you.
All right. as I was saying, I was very impressed by one of these measures, which are not provided for in the NCA, as you say, about the loan balance, if you're facing the victim of a retrenchment, losing your job if the company has been liquidated, and the fact that the outstanding loan balance is paid out. I think that's setting a very good example. But thank you very much. Let's allow members to raise their questions, make comments. Honourable Mkhongi, followed by Honourable Hildewis.
I just have one question, Jefferson. What types of products do you offer to people who receive social grants?
Thank you very much.
That is Honourable Hill-Lewis.
Thank you, Mr. Mashia and Mr. Krauser. I have a few questions. Firstly, emolument attachment orders. A few years ago, you made a public commitment to stop using them. Have you honored that commitment? And how many emolument attachment orders do you currently have in place still? Then, what is the total installment to income ratio that you, the maximum total installment to income ratio that you target at Capitec for loan products? Then, earlier this year, there was much publicity about your multi-loan product. Please confirm whether you have stopped offering that product or whether you are still offering it. And what redress are you offering to those customers who you did offer that loan to in the past and who may be still be paying off those loans? And is that something that you think our subcommittee could consider? Then I would like to have your view on the voluntary debt review for low-income consumers that was offered by your colleagues from African Bank. Do you support that proposal to be funded by the lenders? And then there has been some publicity around this, but I've never actually heard an answer from Capitec. In 2014 and 2015, there was a 5-month or nearly 6-month strike on the Rustenburg Platinum Belt, in which time you offered 10,500 new loans to striking workers when they weren't receiving income for 5 months. So how did you confirm their income during that time in order to offer them those loans? And what percentage of those loans are now non-performing? Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Hill-Lewis. Now, if there's anyone else who wishes to comment or raise a question, now is the time to do it. Given that there is no one, will you please respond, Capitec? Pardon, did you have your hand up? No.
If they do not have all the replies, they can do it in writing as well.
I'm aware of that. It's not something I'm not aware of. But let's at least allow them. They haven't even responded to one, Honourable Kornoff. Let's show them some courtesy. Right.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. Honourable Mr. Mkhongi, thank you for that question. We have debated how much and what we should offer clients receiving social grants. For quite a few years now, we don't provide loans to clients receiving social grants for more than 5 years. But we do offer banking products at, I believe, very competitive cost. So there's 700 branches countrywide. Rural, city, semi-rural, very well represented throughout the country, accessible, and we offer banking with very good savings products to social grant clients.
Sure, if you've finished, your mic's still on.
Yes, so I will now address the next questions. Now, Lewis.
No, my worry is that you answered one product. I said, what types of products do you offer? But you said you do not give them loans. But what other products do you give them?
All products offered to all of our other clients. So the Capitec products, from savings to fixed deposits, an application or an app, in other words, having the ability to bank on the cell phone, all going to branch to withdraw money, the ATMs that we have available, all products that we offer to all our clients, we offer to SASSA loan grants.
Thank you very much. Do you wish to come in, Mr. Seer? No. Right. Members, I'm looking at you.
Honourable Mr. Lewis's questions?
Yes, we're still outstanding there. There's no one else because we don't want to pick up afterwards. Thank you.
There's quite a few questions here. Firstly, emolument attachment orders. We were part of the process in the industry to make sure that there's no abuse, but we do have emolument attachment orders still outstanding in the name of Capitec. We do go through a process of making sure that employers, for example, do not deduct more than what is already settled. So there's a full settlement, and that's quite a process. So just stopping emolument order attachments is not the responsible part. The responsible part is the ones that you have got that is still being deducted by the employers, and those must be stopped and also refunded to clients. That's quite a process if you can't go and get hold of that client. So there's quite a, and also then emolument attachment orders, the way it is working already, is that a client is notified of the court date. The client, in other words, cannot say that the client didn't sign the contact consent, and the client must be present in court, which means the client's bread and butter or income calculation is done. So this is a client that is still receiving a salary, a client that's able to pay, and only paying the part that the client can afford, because at the end of the process, and this is not early stage, this is very late stage, this is after being in arrears for at least 6 months. Because remember, we've got call centers, but when we hand over to an external debt collector, we haven't told you that yet, but they also apply a call focus. They also try and get hold of the client. They also try and get a new debit order. So this is the last resort for where a client is still able to pay, he's got a job, but thus far haven't been willing to pay, and then arrives in court. And the decision is then made by the magistrate and stands by the magistrate. I will also provide further statistics to support that answer, and in the statistics show how many we still have in play, and how few still today goes through court, very little. Number three, the maximum installment to income or repayment to income. That is not something we've ever done. We've never lent to a client, and we've never helped a client to borrow based on a maximum installment. We've always done a maximum installment to income was the question. So we've never applied a maximum. We do the full calculation. We adjust and amend the income from the payslip. We deduct the variable income. So we do a full discussion with the client. We do three calculations. The one is per the NCA, and that one is often less than 5%. That's the least. But we take the others, most of the cases, because they are the least. There we take the largest of debit orders and credit bureau obligations. We take the actual living expenses of a client, and if that's more than the living expenses per the NCA. So, and then we take the least of all of this. So we have to do a complete calculation of actual real sustainable income, actual obligations, and actual living expenses. And we do have benchmarks that we apply, for example, the NCA living expenses. But we don't apply a percentage of gross or a percentage of net. Then the question regarding malt loans. Malt loans were offered up till last year, September. We're very proud of that product. There's certainly no regress planned regarding the product. Very proud of the product. But the product was changed because we were part of influencing the industry to ask for payslips. So as we were part of the industry process of asking for payslips, we sacrificed our own product, and that product was stopped before September. None of those malt loans are obviously still in the run. Our clients don't just take up malt loans, they also have term loans, and some of those clients are still outstanding. But today we offer a facility. It is for consumption need, and as a credit card, something that one has to issue very carefully with a full affordability calculation and manage and monitor very carefully, like a credit card, because it's a facility and priced as a facility. The voluntary debt mediation, it should be a new debate for a new business case, and in that we should agree as an industry, we should pay for it. As I said at the moment, we do, well, last month, to give you a bit of insight in the Capitec world, and it's smaller than some of the other players' world, and in Standard Bosch, we can't handle much more. It's close to Slavstad, so we only do unsecured. but we've dealt with 50,000 clients at our own cost. We haven't charged penalty costs. We haven't charged any cent for that treatment and engagement with the client. So why would we want to charge for a VDNS? We want the client to be assisted with regards to his other debt. But we're very willing to open up that business case. It's not just for me to say, and it should be an industry discussion. It simply must just be convened formally. Then lastly, the strike. Also very proud to say that we've assisted the mine workers during the process where there was a strike. We certainly did not offer a loan when there was not income. For example, in those days, a malt loan cannot be offered if a client didn't pay. So there's no ways we could have lent. And this is all system, so it's fully automated. So when I talk about affordability calculation, or when I talk about rescheduling or offering a malt loan, there's no ways a client could receive another malt loan if the previous one wasn't paid. The question is, should the client have received the one in the month that he had the problem? In that process, we are at the moment, unfortunately, in a court case. So as I said, I'm very proud of the product, but it's not possible for me to explain to you why I'm proud of that product. The loans that was given to those clients was definitely not 10,000. We have responded to those journalists personally. We've given the data through to the journalist, and the number of mine clients that we've assisted were, obviously not all of them were going through a strike, were way less. And on a client level, it was in the hundreds, not in the thousands. I remember now the figure that we're giving through. Unfortunately, this takes us to the discussion of the malt loan, and I would love to share that with you. Unfortunately, we've been taken to court, and we are waiting for that date.
Right. Now, if there's anything else outstanding and you wish to expand on any of the responses, please do so in writing. Mr. Hermans, I have seen your hand, has requested all representatives of the banks here that at times it was not easy to hear you, and that he would appreciate it if you would send your responses back in writing, including the ones you addressed right here in the house itself. So that doesn't just apply to Capitec, it applies to everyone. Honourable Hill Lewis.
Thank you. May I ask the two brief follow-ups, which they can respond to in writing if it needs to be. Thank you. I just wonder, since the Stellenbosch Legal Aid Clinic case, have you done an audit of all your outstanding or currently still in place emolument attachment orders to see how many of them are obtained in a magisterial district other than the one in which the client is domiciled? And have you scrapped those attachment orders? And then if you could just provide us with the total number of emolument attachment orders that you still have in place. I don't mind if you don't have that number at hand. You can happily send it to us. The reason I raised the redress for multi-loan customers is because our subcommittee is looking at proposals around debt relief. And one of the proposals that we may consider is for those customers who were made to pay initiation fees and administration fees on the multi-loan product that you offer them every month. So if they took out a 1,000 rand loan once a month for 12 months, they had to pay an initiation fee for each of those 12 months as if it was a new loan. Now, so, you know, I don't think that's something that Capitec should be proud of, frankly, charging those customers an initiation fee each month. And it's a serious question. I'm not being facetious. What redress is available to those customers, or what redress can our subcommittee consider for, at the very least, the refund of those administration fees, or initiation fees, rather? Then, on the voluntary debt review, I appreciate that it must be an industry discussion, and of course that is true. But the time for the discussion is now, because our subcommittee is meeting and is preparing a memorandum. And it is a proposal that we have been discussing for a long time in this committee with the NCR, and it was raised on Tuesday. I'm not sure whether you were there at the meeting on Tuesday, but it was raised again on Tuesday by the Debt Counsellors Association. And it's you know, it's a concept at least with some tweaking and with some details to be ironed out that I certainly support. So, you know, the time for that discussion is very much now, and it would be interesting to have your formal input on that, even if it is in writing.
We would like the response in writing, and it would be much appreciated. With respect to members who sit on the subcommittee, that Mr. Honourable Williams there is the chairperson of that subcommittee, and Honourable Hill Lewis is a member. Honourable Mantash, who unfortunately is very ill, and also the Honourable Alberts, am I correct? We would have liked someone else to sit there. It's just unfortunate that they're sitting on another committee when this meets. Am I correct there? Yes. Labour and? They're both Labour. Right. So there is that challenge. But at any point, if you feel you want to add, come back again, please engage with Mr. Hermans, because I do know the subcommittee may have wanted to also engage separately with you once they've had a chance to digest what they've got. But I do appreciate the manner, cooperative manner that you have taken today, and some of you, in fact all of you, have given us some gems that we could use, but of course we are concerned about some of the other practices which were raised by different honourable MPs in this regard. But I don't want to preempt anything. Suffice to say, we simply want to try and get to a position as to what should be the way forward in this regard, because that requires the report or the memorandum to be adopted by Parliament before we pursue it. I also want to thank Chief Executive Officer of the National Credit Regulator, Ms. Machigari, for being here this afternoon, and also Mr. Mashapa, the Company Secretary, and also the Advocate Charmaine van der Merwe, our Senior Legal Advisor in the Drafting Office itself. Thank you for spending all this time with us. I want to apologize for the poor quality of the sound to all members, in fact, and just to indicate to members that Tuesday, as they know, is cancelled. We unfortunately are unable to use that day, but that we would expect to, we can't use the Thursday, as you all know, it's the budgets, but we would have to, it looks like, meet on Friday, but I will be consulting Mr. Hermans on the matter. Is that all right with you? That being the case, the meeting is adjourned till next week. Thank you.